This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Joel Rosenbaum. Today is July 24, 2009. I am in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mr. Rosenbaum is joining me by phone from Eatontown, New Jersey. Is that correct, sir?
That is correct.
Okay. All right. If you don't mind, if we could begin by, if you could tell me a little bit of biographical information about yourself. First of all, when and where were you born?
I was born in Jersey City, New Jersey, in the Margaret Haig Maternity Hospital on January 9, 1945. My family lived in Jersey City for the first 4 years of my life, and my father was a postal clerk. He worked on 90 Church Street in downtown New York, actually right across from the X World Trade Center.
Okay.
And actually, that building was damaged in 9/11, that part of the post office.
Oh, okay.
My family moved to Linden, New Jersey, about 18 miles roughly south of New York City, around 1949.
Okay.
And we lived walking distance to the train station. My family never owned a car,
mm-hmm.
but public transportation was nearby. My father commuted to New York City every day until he retired. I went through the entire Linden, New Jersey school system from grade school to high school. As a matter of fact, very interestingly, is that a well-known Vietnam POW also spent most of his life in Linden. He was born and left Amarillo in 1951 down the street from you, and his family settled in Linden for his growing years. It was George Coker.
Okay.
And he is mentioned in what's his name's book, John McCain's book, Faith of My Fathers. He's one of the few prisoners that escaped for a while and was recaptured. It's quite a tale.
Okay.
Anyhow, I, as I said, I grew up in Linden. It was basically a, it's a big industry town. The Texas Eastern oil pipeline from Texas ended up there. It was its eastern terminus. It was built during World War II. Large oil refineries, a large GM plant, which recently closed a couple of years ago, and a busy, it's called the Northeast Corridor. I only live two blocks away from the railroad station. It's kind of noisy. It was, we're on the approach path to Newark Liberty Airport. And there was also a local airport that was about a mile and a half away that was built during World War II. They were building Hellcat Navy fighters at the GM plant.
Okay.
They built the airport there to test them. Jewish. There was a small but active Jewish community that my life revolved around. I was a member of the Boy Scout troops, explorers. I worked very hard in high school. My parents didn't have much money, but they put away some money to help me through college. I got a state scholarship to Rutgers University. And upon graduation, I entered Rutgers in New Brunswick, New Jersey. I went through ROTC for 4 years that time, Air Force ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
I always wanted to be a meteorologist, and I couldn't afford the schools that had the program for a B.S. in meteorology. Rutgers had a couple of courses and a master's program. So the other thing was is the Air Force at that time had a shortage of weather officers.
Okay.
And if you had some calculus and physics, if you got commissioned, they would send you to one of about a dozen universities. So I was with that in mind. I liked AFROTC. Rutgers had an active Army and Air Force ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
It became voluntary in 1961, so they had to be aggressive. The instructors were really interesting. One of the instructors was a major at that time, Major Hess.
Okay.
Had been shot down and was a POW on the Schweinfurt raid.
Oh, wow.
These were really interesting people. The commandant of cadets, Colonel Klatnoff, was instrumental in converting the American Eagle squadrons in England over to the Army Air Forces when the United States entered the war.
Oh, yes, sir.
These people were living history. They were approachable. I went through the what was called the College of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences at Rutgers, which was changed to Cook College, and now it's been changed again to the College of Environmental and Biological Sciences. The Ag School was a lot like Texas A&M. A lot of the instructors were reserve military officers, relatively conservative, helpful.
Mm-hmm.
The downtown campuses, a lot of the instructors were nasty, unhelpful. They wouldn't show up for appointments with students.
Right.
Rutgers at that time had really too many students,
okay.
So they tried to flunk people out. And when the Air Force sent me to Texas A&M, it was a totally different atmosphere.
Mm.
Now, the Ag School wasn't like that, but unfortunately at that time, the liberal arts courses that were required, you had to take them at the downtown campus.
Okay.
And again, the instruction, a lot of it was by student assistants, you know, graduate students.
Sure.
And a lot of the top names, the professors, were involved in research work.
Right.
I actually taught myself integral and differential calculus.
Wow.
From an outline book. It was so terrible. So I learned a lot of discipline. I had the same instructor for two of the different advanced courses.
Okay.
So I saw what the handwriting on the wall was, and I played the game. I bought a Shams outline series in Barnes & Noble and forced myself 2 hours a day. I would go to the lectures, but they were useless.
Mm.
And I disciplined myself to do problems and learn it myself.
Right.
So I was, out of a class of 20, I was one of four people that passed and got a C.
Oh,
and the rest, it was terrible.
Right.
Again, totally different at Texas A&M. I was pleasantly surprised.
Mm-hmm.
But the ag instructors were excellent. I mean, they were, you know, down to earth.
Okay.
And one of the graduates of the ag school from years ago had been a Russian immigrant Jew, Selman Waksman, who got the Nobel Prize for discovering streptomycin. His face was on the cover of Time magazine, I think in the 1940s or 50s. And he donated the royalties to the Microbiology Institute at Rutgers.
Hmm.
And as an immigrant Jew, he was not treated very well, you know, in 1914 or 15.
Right.
When he went there, they ripped his clothes and everything.
Mm.
But, again, he rose above it.
Right.
It was an interesting time to be at Rutgers because the anti-war movement started. Unfortunately, it started to be taken out on ROTC, which was, you know, hey, we had the draft hanging over our head.
Sure.
I had people arguing with me when I went into the advanced program. I said, look, I like weather. I said, I'd rather do something that I enjoyed doing for 4 years rather than wait to be drafted and hate it.
Right.
You know, so there was a number of people that went through the first 2 years that just dropped out. I don't want to go in for 4 years. Of course, the way to get out of it was to keep on going to graduate school up until they had the lottery.
Right.
I had no problem with it. There weren't a lot of Jewish guys in Air Force ROTC. I'd say there was, out of a graduating class of 60 of us that were commissioned in Air Force ROTC, I'd say there were four or five. But Rutgers, being in the Northeast, did have a 15% to 20% Jewish population.
Okay.
Fairly heavy. As a matter of fact, an Army ROTC who graduated with me at the same time, Jack Jacobs, got the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Okay.
In Vietnam. Now, he fortunately lived to tell about it.
Sure.
He retired as a colonel in the Army, and he's on MSNBC, and sometimes NBC is their military analyst.
Okay.
There was also a lot of hard feelings when the anti-war movement started in the mid-60s because New Brunswick had a large anti-communist Hungarian population.
Mm-hmm.
They were brought in after the turn of the century. Johnson & Johnson its headquarters, which was in New Brunswick, which it still is,
right.
A big pharmaceutical and medical supply company, and they imported a lot of Hungarians to work in their factories. And there was a further influx in 1956 with the Hungarian uprising.
Okay.
They reopened Camp Kilmer, which was closed about 1953, to receive Hungarian refugees, knowing that the New Brunswick area had a large Hungarian population, that these people would be comfortable in being absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
Camp Kilmer was right behind the Edison, New Jersey Transit Station, and extended almost all the way to the east bank of the Raritan River across from Rutgers. Eventually, most of it became the Livingston College of Rutgers.
Okay.
But anyhow, you had this huge Hungarian population. When the anti-war movement started, they were angry because they were strongly anti-communist.
Sure.
You had a lot of liberal professors. One became relatively infamous, Eugene Genovese.
Mm-hmm.
He, I believe, was either political science or history. He got up at a teach-in, and I went to one of them just out of curiosity, so
mm-hmm.
I personally observed it. He said he'd welcome a Viet Cong victory in Vietnam. Well,
right.
This didn't go over too big with some of the population.
Sure.
Some of the New Jersey legislators wanted him fired. It became the issue in a gubernatorial election, but they kept him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he left on his own.
Okay.
Interesting, at the teach-in that I went to, one of the members of the audience's son was serving as a Coast Guard officer in Vietnam.
Okay.
And he asked everybody to get up and, say the Pledge of Allegiance, which I thought was nice, whatever.
Right.
But it got worse after I was commissioned and left. Again, the students, in some cases encouraged by professors, were, aroused. They tried to burn down one of the Air Force ROTC buildings.
Mm.
They disrupted drill. I mean, you want to take it out on the politicians, that's one thing.
Right.
But if you, we were going into the military because it was our duty. We
sure.
didn't make the decision to commit troops to Vietnam. The politicians did.
Right.
But this is one of the unfortunate things about the Vietnam War, is that the veterans and the people that served really took the heat, and some of it was propagated by politicians for their own, advancement.
Right.
Again, for me, ROTC at Rutgers was a good experience. During the seasons when we wouldn't have drill, we had drill, 8 weeks in the fall and 8 weeks in the spring. Meantime,
okay.
for extra credit, they used to, if you wanted to, you could see movies, which was great. Survival on the Tundra. And, of course, the narrator on a lot of the movies was Jimmy Stewart,
okay.
who eventually became a brigadier general, in the reserve.
Right.
It was interesting. And in the junior year, I went for advanced summer training in Maxwell Air Force Base. For some reason, everybody else went to Plattsburgh up near the Canadian border. I went to Maxwell.
Mm.
It was great because they had the best food in the Air Force. They flew us all over because it's home and still is home of the Air War College.
Right.
You had a bunch of colonels that had to get in flight time. They flew us down to Eglin. They flew us on orientation trips. They flew us into Tennessee.
Mm.
I got a chance to ride in a two-seater T-33 trainer. The base facilities were nice. I actually was there a month or two after the famous Selma March,
okay.
so I got to see some of that.
Hmm.
It was a little bit awkward. I was the only Jewish guy among 300 cadets from the South. Most of
right.
them were friendly. One guy, he refused to shake my hand when he found out where I was from.
Hmm.
He said, "This here's rebel country." I figured, all right, who cares?
Right.
It was an experience for me. It was, mm-hmm. Like I said, it was the first time in my life, not only did I ever flew, you know, down to Montgomery, Alabama from Newark.
Right.
But I got a chance to meet people from Texas A&M, mm-hmm. VMI, the Citadel. And what was interesting is Rutgers had a good program for Air Force ROTC.
Okay.
But some of these guys, not from Texas A&M, but like from the Citadel mm-hmm. and from VMI, they were so sick of having to do the military things 24/7. Some of them had real bad attitudes down there.
Hmm.
I mean, there's no question that they knew the drill manual better than I did. But I enjoyed myself. To me, it was a treat. And that's the advantage of an ROTC program, you know, at a diverse school. You get diverse people, diverse opinions. When you start just concentrating on military schools, you get one point of view, you know, it doesn't give you the diversity that you get when you have, you know, people coming from different educations and parts of the country and even different backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
After I applied for weather officer training and I was accepted, what it was is after you got commissioned, if you had the required physics and math,
okay.
calculus, you would be sent to one of about a dozen schools. I wanted to go to NYU or Penn State. Texas A&M was my third choice.
Okay.
Just as well. It worked out very well. At that time, Texas A&M was underpopulated as opposed to what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
It's 6,000 or 7,000 students, very quiet town. The weather department was very well staffed. Of course, they had a lot of Air Force contracts for graduate study and weather officer training. The only downside was it was all male at that time. You had to be a female who lived in Bryan College Station in order to be accepted.
Okay.
They started accepting women in 63 on a very limited basis. So the social life was not great, but I enjoyed what I did.
Right.
And, you know, there wasn't the parking problems that there is today or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And being a train buff, I took out on around the countryside, you know, and I, you know, watched Texas trains and visited mm-hmm. railroad stations in my free time.
Okay.
And I later developed that into something. The other thing was they had a weather radar there that we used to go up and we used to watch it, you know, when storms are coming in. The instruction was very good.
Okay.
They were more concerned about keeping people in school. And, of course, the meteorology department depended on the contracts, you know, with the Air Force.
Okay.
So it was an interesting experience. I used to drive over to Austin a lot of times just to see people. The University of Texas had a similar program at the time, but eventually it closed down. They no longer offer meteorology at University of Texas. I believe Texas Tech has a program, and Texas A&M, of course, still has their program.
Right.
So it was a 12-month intensive program.
Mm-hmm.
I had some meteorology at Rutgers. You know, they had a couple of courses. I had
right.
some climatology. I had some micrometeorology, a few other courses as well. Plus, I had my undergraduate degree is in agriculture, so I had a broad environmental background.
Mm-hmm.
The only unfortunate thing about Texas A&M is because of the educational requirements of the state of Texas at that time, they refused to grant a BS degree for the program to
mm-hmm.
us. Now, there was other schools, and I got proof of this later, at Penn State, all the Air Force people that went through there got BS degrees.
Okay.
The problem was the state of Texas education requirements at that time required a mandatory 6 credits in political science and 6 credits in history, which you couldn't take under the circumstances. So I got a certificate. They told us at the time, well, you know, a certificate just as good. My first assignment was Otis Air Force Base, Massachusetts.
Okay.
It was a total change. That was a long drive from College Station, Texas to Falmouth, Mass. Pretty location, but it, at that time, come September, the beaches would empty out. you had the run of the restaurants as opposed to the summer, but the weather was fog. You got fog, you got ground fog, you got sea fog, you got all kinds of fog, and they were, it was an interesting experience, but we had low priority. It was an Air Defense Command base with the Vietnam War going on, so I was working six shifts on, one shift off.
Okay.
We'd work like two night shifts, two evening shifts, a day off, two day shifts. You never got like a weekend off. You would get like part of a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
I would have extra duties. You'd end up going to your extra duty meetings on your day off.
Mm.
We had a non-usable weather radar that was useless out of a B-17.
Mm.
We had to call RAPCON control. We would ask them for reports on echoes. One night when everything went down, I had my portable radio listening for static to indicate whether or not there would be, that there was thunderstorms in the area. I mean, it's not primitive.
Right.
But also, they were flying outmoded EC-121H radar observation planes with honeycomb with fuel cells and radar gear.
Okay.
These were the Constellations with the hump on the top. They were replaced later by AWACS, but they lost three of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't really survivable in the water because, again, they were, over-heavy fuel cells, radar gear.
Mm-hmm.
I did fly a volunteer mission with them just to understand what it was about.
Mm-hmm.
I was the only one that did volunteer to do it. The mission I flew on, we had to make an emergency landing at Langley Air Force Base, Virginia.
Oh, boy.
It was quite a sight coming in. We saw that it was at night. About 2,000 feet above the surface. You could see the lights from the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel, and we're dumping fuel, but it was an adventure.
Sure.
We made it in, and then we were stuck there for like a day or two because they had to fly down parts from Otis, and they weren't real happy to see us at Langley because the planes were heavy and tended to tear up the runway.
Oh, wow.
Also, there was a Vietnam unit that was secretly training at Otis that only years later did I find out what they did. They were using the Constellations, the four-engine aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
They called them the Batcats later on.
Okay.
I think it was the 553rd Recon Wing. All as we know is they flew daily missions from Otis down to Crestview, Florida, down towards Eglin, Herbert Field.
Mm-hmm.
What it turned out later on, they were involved in what was called Igloo White, I-G-L-O-O. They were involved with they didn't drop the sensors on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, but apparently they received the radio signals from them.
Mm-hmm.
They flew out of Thailand. Initially, we thought they took off en masse secretly, and they had priority on everything from toilet paper to you name it.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, what they did was hush-hush, and after that, to resupply them, we used to brief C-141 Starlifters
come
into Otis and fly from Otis through Canada up to Alaska to Yokota, Japan, and then over to Thailand to resupply them with stuff. Unfortunately, I think they lost about two planes due to weather-related accidents in Thailand. I have contact with the group because they raised some questions that I was able to answer.
Okay.
And again, it was only years later did I find out what they did.
Right.
I just knew that it was hush hush. I believe they go under the name of Batcats. And,
right.
When I got to Otis, I love history and I like meteorology. I volunteered for Vietnam. Couldn't see the sense of the morale at the base was low. These guys didn't want to fly these Connies. They had EC-121s, and they had F-101 Voodoo interceptors. Interestingly enough, when we had to make the emergency landing at Langley Air Force Base, when the crew got up the next morning, they made a joke. They said, I couldn't get any sleep last night. I was worrying about all the Russian planes that were getting through while we had to make an emergency landing here. I mean, they knew in the missile age this was a joke.
Right.
So, you know, I thought this is what I was trained for. This was history. As long as I'm doing something as a weather officer, I have no problem with it.
Right.
The other thing that did concern me, too, being Jewish, that the Russians were arming the Arabs to the teeth with missiles, planes. I'm sure whatever we learned in Vietnam would go back and forth.
Right.
I know the Israelis had snagged the MiG-21. They got a defector, and during the Six-Day War, they actually captured even more. And I know a lot of that was going back and forth between the United States. So, you know, I figured, hey. So I was at Otis slightly less than a year. I got my orders to go to Tropical Weather School, which was good because the weather in Vietnam and in the tropics is very different than what, you know, and how it's predicted than what you experience in Texas or in the east part of the United States. Not everybody was sent to Tropical Weather School, and that was unfortunate.
Yeah.
And it was a great opportunity. I was sent to Chanute Air Force Base out in Rantoul, Illinois. They had to put me up at a motel because there were, you know, so many people being trained. I lived well. My friend fixed me up. One of my friends from Otis was from Chicago. Mm-hmm. Fixed me up with a girl from Chicago. We hit it off. She'd come down every weekend, or I'd go up to Chicago. So, you know, before I went over, I spent some time with her. We had an understanding after I came back. It was a nice way to go off. My parents were upset, obviously.
Sure.
I'll never forget, you know, my mother crying on the phone when I made my last call from McCord Air Force Base with the plane, the 141s taking off all, you know, all night. McCord was a major resupply base and transport base in the Seattle-Tacoma area.
Okay.
I stayed over at the BOQ, visiting officers' quarters, had the ominous name, and I actually saved my stationery from there, called the Monsoon Inn.
Huh.
Well, interesting name for a visiting officer's quarters. The reception area, you know, for where we were taking the plane to Vietnam, there were Army and Air Force guys there. It was something out of the Twilight Zone. 30 coffee cups, kind of sloppy.
Uh-huh.
Some Red Cross workers there. Nobody was in a real great mood. And on the flight over, we stopped briefly in Hawaii to refuel for about 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Had a chance to get off a postcard to my parents. And then it was a long flight for 12 hours. Now, my seatmate, I remember to this day, he came from Las Cruces, New Mexico. He was an Army captain from, he had graduated from New Mexico State in agriculture.
Okay.
So we had an interesting conversation going on because my, you know, initial degree was in agriculture. He was saying how he couldn't believe the Army justice system, that he said, you know, he saw guys getting the book thrown at them for minor infractions, and some guys, if the people were in a good mood, they had a major infraction, they let it, you know, slip by.
Mm-hmm.
He said it was the most unfair system he ever, you know, saw.
Mm-hmm.
Our next stop was stopped in the middle of the night at Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines.
Okay.
Two or three hours. And then it was about an hour and a half to 2 hour flight to Cameron Bay. We landed in the dark. There were all kinds of flares going off, a terrible stench, like a backed up sewer. I'll never forget that smell. It was kind of spooky because it was at night with flares going off.
Right.
They picked us up in a truck to take us over to the visiting officers' quarters. I told one guy, get down. You don't know what the hell they expect. Don't have your head standing up.
Right.
And then one guy was showing me, you weren't allowed to bring your own personal weapons. He didn't care. He wrapped his pistol up in parts. He had it totally disassembled. And, of course, they didn't have metal detectors at that time. And he reassembled it at the visiting officer's quarters.
Okay.
They had no one to pick me up and orient me in the middle of the night, so I had to wait for the morning. And they took me up to the our officer's quarters on top of what was called RMK BRJ Hill. It was a pretty spot, but it was kind of remote. In terms of Cameron was not in a city or anything, which was to its advantage. Nha Trang was about 20 miles north, was much more of a city.
Okay.
But that was a disadvantage because there wasn't a problem with infiltration. Vietnamese had to get off the base when the sun went down.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people in the cities, the infiltration and rocket attacks were a lot more frequent. I lived in a tin Quonset hut without air conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I compared notes with some weather officers that were with the Army. They were living in tents, so, I mean, mm-hmm. this was a step up.
Right.
The base facilities were decent. I mean, they weren't luxurious by any means. My friend Wilson Castillo, who was a weather officer with me at Otis,
okay.
he got sent to Da Nang about 4 or 5 months after I was, you know, sent to Cameron. And I went to visit him at Da Nang before I went home. They had nice facilities up there.
Mm-hmm.
They had regular brick, air-conditioned barracks, you know, comfortable beds. But they got hit a lot with rockets, so, mm-hmm. you know, you take your choice.
Sure.
The officers' club wasn't real great, but they were open till like 4 in the morning at one time. You could always get a hamburger and fries. There was a BX that was open 7 days a week. That's one of the things I liked about Vietnam, was as a shift worker on a stateside base, if you work in weekends, you're screwed because most of the stuff is, you know, closed.
Right.
But in Vietnam, it was 24/7, which was fine for me.
Mm-hmm.
When I got there, initially I was just a staff weather officer. They had about... it was made up of 4 officers, about 3 enlisted, 4 forecasters, and maybe about 12 or 14 enlisted men as observers and maintenance men. But there was a problem. The commander was a major who was not real adept at leading a weather detachment. He had been in computers to forecast winds, and he was out of his element. And a lot of this stuff, that there were screw-ups in the weather assignments in Vietnam, is outlined in a book called Thor's Legion by Fuller.
Okay.
And this is published by the American Meteorological Society. It's very frank. A whole chapter on Southeast Asia,
okay.
where the Air Weather Service was just taking people to fill slots, not really seeing what their background was. And this major was totally out of his atmosphere, was terrified of having to make forecasts. He ended up getting a letter of reprimand at the end of his tour, which is unusual.
Okay.
So he picked me. He had a couple of lazy captains. I was a first lieutenant, but I had been to tropical weather school. I was interested in weather. He picked up on it. He fired his captain, who was chief forecaster, made me his chief forecaster, and I was in charge of 3 captains. But I liked what I did. What I would do is, Cameron was an extremely busy base.
Okay.
We had the 12th TAC fighter wing, which flew F-4 Phantoms. The commander, I believe when I was there, was Colonel White, who at one time flew X-15s. One of the other colonels was a real gentleman. Colonel Rushworth also flew the X-15s. Briefing these guys was a pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to fly no matter what the weather. I mean, these were dyed-in-the-wool pilots. You could tell them there was a thunderstorm over the base with 40 miles an hour wind. You know, they're a pilot. They're going to fly it.
Right.
You got some of the guys got thrown in the cockpit pit, majors, lieutenant colonels, that weren't real happy about it, and they thought you made the weather. And they, you know, if the forecast wasn't to their liking, they would be up your behind.
Right.
For the first month or two that I was there, they were still flying missions over the southern part of North Vietnam. I think by about November, December, they had a bombing halt, in effect, and they were just flying missions in South Vietnam. But they also had aircraft that would scramble on alert that in case, friendly troops got into a fight and they were pinned down, these guys would scramble real quick and, provide air support. So it was, on alert 24 hours. It was, everything was going. They had a C-7A Caribou two-engine transports that could land in, the smallest of third airfields that provided tactical support to remote Army bases. They had C-130s in and out of there all the time. They had the Alsi command post. Some of them came TDY from Chung Ching Kwan Air Base on the southern part of, I believe, Taiwan, and some, I believe, from Okinawa.
Okay.
We had R&R flights went out of Cameron to Darwin, Australia, to where was it? To Penang in Malaysia, to Hawaii. We also had incoming troops on charter flights, as I myself did, came over. We had 141s coming in all the time. We had there was a major Air Force and Army hospital. We had AeroVac flights in and out on 141s. We had some C-118s that used to come in for briefings that would fly AeroVacs to Clark Air Base. We also briefed and gave climatological briefing to was Army Light Aviation Outfit at Dong Bathin about. It's about 2 or 3 miles across from us. You could actually visually see them, but they had their own small airfield for their light aircraft and helicopters. We had secret CIA outfits. They went under the name of Continental Air.
Okay.
They would ask, I need a briefing, and say, where are you going? I can't tell you. It's a secret. And we played 20 questions, and what we end up doing was giving them a general briefing for all of Southeast Asia. There was some strange operating units, Army Radio Research. Well, I found out later what that was. They were flying P-2Vs, which were actually two-engine naval maritime patrols, but they weren't using them for that. They were using them for gunships, and they were using them for the Eagle White Project of sensors and sensor monitoring. And also they monitored VC communications. And the Navy was flying out of Cameron. They were flying P-2 market time patrols. And at the time that I was there, John Kerry was also attached to the senator that ran for president. He was attached to a swift boat unit out of Cameron.
Right. Okay.
So it was an extremely busy place with an interesting history, which I will send you. I belong to the C-7A Caribou Association.
Okay.
I did a lot of briefing with them. I wrote a history of Cameron Bay for them.
Okay, great.
Very fascinating history. That it turns out it's more interesting and apropos to me than I even thought it was.
Okay.
Back in 1905, around 1905, the Russian fleet assembled there for a battle with the Japanese, in the Japanese-Russian War.
Right.
Of course, the Russians lost.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother and grandfather on my mother's side came from Russia.
Mm-hmm.
My mother told me that her mother used to sing these sad Russian songs about losing the war to Japan. Very strange, and here I am
right.
The next number of years.
Huh.
It turns out the Japanese, occupied it from the French and used it as a jumping off base to invade Singapore and Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
The United States made two attacks on Cameron, one by B-29s and the other was Naval Grumman, I think, 6-5F. I have it, typed up. It's not
sure.
They had two attacks on there, and then, of course, the French used it as their evacuation port from 1954 to 1956 when they evacuated Indochina.
Mm-hmm.
The Americans surveyed it in 1964 with the naval hydrographic ship Epping Forest. And then they started, they decided that was going to be a major base. And by, I believe, November of 66, the runway opened for the F-4s. They wanted to build a second concrete runway, but there wasn't any time, so they used steel matting. And when I was there, I heard the plan was the United States wanted it as a permanent base, and there was talk that Pan Am wanted to take it over as like a Club Med. So there was a lot of interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of weather, in Vietnam, basically, there's really two seasons, and it's governed by the monsoon. The idea that monsoon is heavy rain is totally fallacious.
Okay.
The monsoon, by strict definition, means seasonal wind.
Okay.
And what it is, for several months out of the year in Vietnam, the wind is from the northeast, which comes in off the South China Sea. What happens then, roughly from September through about January, is it's real rainy along the coast, along the mountain side of the South China Sea.
Okay.
Inland, generally, it's relatively dry. In North Vietnam, because there's fronts that come down, and a lot of their area is exposed to the coast, the weather is crappy during the northeast monsoon. But it's mainly a morning phenomenon most of the time. When the sun would set at Cameron,
okay,
an hour or two later, you feel these drops falling on you, and it would rain intermittently all night. The sun would come up, and you look out over the water, and it'd be ominous-looking clouds, but they actually topped off at like 9,000 feet. Usually by afternoon, skies were generally clear. Sometimes if a front would hang up or there would be a speed max, things like that, you would get prolonged rain. The problem was is the Russians found out when they occupied Cameron Bay, during the periods of rain with the mountains so close to the shore, you have low clouds that hide the mountains, particularly along the coastal bases. If you misjudge, you're going to buy the mountain.
Right.
And that's what happened, in a number of cases, even in peacetime with the Russians.
Okay.
Anyhow, and then there'd be a transition period from about February through April, when basically not much would be happening. You'd have a lot of haze where the burning of the crops, but not much, in terms of weather, other than sometimes low fog in, the low-lying valleys. Then, again, the thing with the monsoons, it's not like spring and summer where you have, spring starts, March 20th through 22nd. It's when the intertropical convergence zone moves up and back and forth, and it's not an exact date. It just when it occurs. It generally occurs within a 30-day period, but, again, there's some fluctuation there.
Okay.
So one of the things the weather people did at the Weather Centrals was tracking the intertropical convergence zone when it was moving up to at least give people an indication. When the southwest monsoon started up, that's when you really had the worst weather over most of Vietnam, except on the coast. Anything on the land side of the mountains, away from the coast, Saigon, Pleiku, all of Thailand, then you get the heavy afternoon thunderstorms,
okay,
which again, for light aircraft, helicopters, are horrendous. And this caused, a number of accidents and other things. Nothing you can do about that other than avoid it. What we would encourage people to do on their routes is, there was a term, feet dry and feet wet. During the southwest monsoon, we would encourage aircraft to fly feet wet. In other words, if you hug the coast, and flew over water, you weren't generally going to hit thunderstorms. If you flew inland, you're going to be dodging thunderstorms the whole time. Again, places like Pleiku would get huge amounts of rain in these thunderstorms. And the odd thing was that Cameron, we had a relatively simple weather radar.
Okay.
It was nice, but it wasn't very sophisticated. Pleiku, which was almost in the center of the country,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't have high-performance jet aircraft. They had lighter jets and, lighter Army aircraft, had a very sophisticated weather radar.
Mm.
The only thing that I could figure out at the time is they're using it to measure rainfall over the Ho Chi Minh Trail, because
okay.
Pleiku wasn't that far.
Right.
But it was much more sinister than that. What it came out was the Americans were seeding the clouds
mm-hmm.
to make it rain more over the Ho Chi Minh Trail, particularly during a southwest monsoon, because they found out, in spite of all the American bombing, that it was the rainfall that slowed the NVA from coming down the trail
mm-hmm.
more than all the bombing. So they figured if they could make it rain more, they could reduce, the traffic. So they were seeding, which was illegal by international convention. Supposedly, you're stealing the rain from somebody and giving it to somebody else.
Okay.
So when you do it, you have to do it under real careful circumstances. But it was kept secret until I think one of the columnists revealed, let the cat out of the bag.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the real reason they probably had the sophisticated radar at Pleiku, not just to measure the rainfall from the southwest monsoon, but to measure estimated rainfall differences, before seeding and after seeding. It came with mixed results. There was a feeling that there was an increase. However, it had a downside, too, in that by making the conditions worse and increasing the rainfall, it also hampered military operations and air operations.
Mm, okay.
So it was damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Right.
And the other thing that I did as chief forecaster is I would brief at 8 o'clock in the morning. I would go over to the Caribou units, and I would give them the briefing of the day of their major bases and for Vietnam. And, of course, you had typhoons, which are basically is the same as a hurricane is, on the East Coast here.
Right.
Except that in the Pacific, they tend to be more destructive because the Pacific Ocean is so much larger than the Atlantic,
okay.
And they can generate a lot more strength. So I did work Typhoon Nina. I did mention it in my diary.
Mm-hmm.
They evacuated the Caribous to Thailand, but it split just as it came ashore. It wasn't, it was some flooding, but it wasn't as bad as it could have been.
Okay.
But this was another concern, too, keeping the units informed of, during the typhoon season. So any of their aircraft coming from the States or, the possibility of what its effect on Vietnam was very important. And
mm-hmm.
5 in the afternoon, we had the 5 o'clock follies. I would brief the F-4 TAC fighter wing on, the weather in Southeast Asia, their proposed targets,
mm-hmm.
their alternate fields, what our weather would be for the next 24 to 36 hours. It was like the 5 o'clock news. They even showed movies of, bombing damage. The intelligence officer would brief. It was a lot of good, interesting experience. That was a briefing amphitheater of about 300 people.
Okay.
I also tried to help our forecast ability. Occasionally during a southwest monsoon, the thunderstorms would occasionally slip over the mountains. Very difficult to predict. And what I did by going through the weather records that were available for about 5 or 6 years was that what I determined was that if it did it on one day, it would usually occur another 2 or 3 days. So I warned our forecasters, you may not be able to forecast for the first day, but if it occurs, forecast for it for the second and third day. And it did work about 70% of the time. I did whatever I could, you know, to increase our forecast performance. The detailed bombing strikes in Laos, though, were prepared out of Tansanut in Saigon.
Okay.
They had access to a secret weather satellite that the United States didn't want to admit to. It was a military satellite, and only a few organizations had access to it.
Hmm.
And this is mentioned in Thor's Legion. The Navy carrier units, their weather people on board, didn't have access to these satellite photos of the cloud cover and weather over North Vietnam until much later, and they weren't happy when they found out about it. It was everybody had their own little secret war. I actually stumbled onto a secret by accident. Cameron was an emergency base for B-52s.
Okay.
Generally, it wasn't a problem until later in the war when they started flying over North Vietnam. They either came out of Guam or Thailand and bombed the trail. But if they had a mechanical malfunction, their preference was to come into Cameron Bay. We actually did have one that make an emergency landing, and they were on their phone like crazy trying to get the plane out of there because they were afraid you know, the VC might hit it.
Mm-hmm.
So they got off before we had any attack. But the other thing that was going on, my commander, the second detachment commander I had in Vietnam, that was a world of difference from the first guy that was there for 6 months, that got a letter of reprimand.
Mm-hmm.
He was good. He had been he worked at Global Weather Central at Offutt for SAC prior to coming to Vietnam.
Okay.
He let slip about the SR-71 when he had a couple of drinks with me once. He mentioned that they had a plane that could fly at 100,000 feet and see the pack, it could identify the pack of brand of cigarettes and the North Vietnamese soldiers. He didn't say too much about it.
Right.
Anyhow, I was supposed to go to a safety officer's meeting, which was part of my extra duties.
Okay.
Got there early at the command post. I'm sitting there. I don't see anybody. And I'm sitting there, and I'm sitting there, and I see all these colonels coming in. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, usually this is a junior officer thing.
Right.
The place is packed with colonels. And the MP walks to the door, and he said, all right, is everybody here that's supposed to be here? You know, I just sat there. What the hell is this?
Right.
They closed the door, and they're pulling out all kinds of diagrams. We called you here from different bases in Vietnam because we're concerned about the SR-71. Well, I'm not about to stand up among 300 people and
right.
saying, oh, I thought this was a safety officer's meeting.
Right.
I sat there. I looked through the manual. What the problem was one of them had to make an emergency landing in Thailand.
Okay.
And they didn't want the locals to see it, and they didn't want it to create an international incident. This was a top-secret plane.
Uh-huh.
What they wanted was primarily they would prefer that it would land at Cameron Bay if it had to land somewhere.
Right.
So they wanted the base commander to hide the plane. He said, we don't have a hangar to hide. What do you want me to do? I mean, they came up with the conclusion, we don't want the locals to get a look at this plane.
Right.
They suggested he throw a big sheet over it. I don't know that they had a sheet. So that was the conclusion.
Right.
So I slithered out of there. I expected to be court-martialed. I told my commander, he just laughed. He said they called the detachment. You know, I usually get to meetings early.
Right.
He said they called the detachment to let you know, that the meeting was canceled. But I was already there.
Right.
So I wasn't aware of that. And it was canceled because they had a secret meeting on the SR-71.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew about the plane. Again, it's kind of frustrating when you figure we had a plane that could fly over North Vietnam at will and take pictures from 100,000 feet, and we still couldn't bring them to their knees.
Right.
We also had some screwballs, some older guys that were still on flying status that shouldn't have been. One guy created a ruckus. It was Colonel Page, an older guy, probably getting senile.
Okay.
He claimed when he was coming in on landing in the daytime, he went into a fog bank and he almost crashed. The visibility was 00.
Hmm.
And he yelled at us, and for the next 3 days when I gave the briefing, he had to put a little show and tell. And you weather people, you need to get your people on their stick to report the fog because they missed it. I almost crashed my plane. I put up with it. I'm a captain. You don't say anything to a colonel.
Sure.
One of his junior people pulled me aside and told me the senile old coot forgot to turn on his defog. And he refused to admit it. He was pointing the finger at us. Hey, if there's one thing I know, it's fog. Cameron hardly gets any fog at all.
Right.
I would have known about it.
Right.
I mean, Otis Air Force Base, we had the fog coming and going.
Sure.
He was just trying to cover his behind by blaming it on somebody else.
Right.
I was happy to see him go. On the other hand, you had Colonel Rushworth, who flew the X-15. I watched him bring in a plane with its landing gear shot up. He could have bailed out. He chose to bring it in. They foamed up the runway, and
mm-hmm.
he made a perfect landing.
Hmm.
So, I mean, some of these guys were a real joy.
Right.
It was, you know, again, it was quite a bit of history. I enjoy military history. I don't have a professional degree in history, but I've written railroad history books, history of Texas railroads, too. So, you know, I had a chance to participate in a piece of history, and, of course, it's from my point of view. I understand that. We all worked hard. It was a matter of trying to do whatever we could to make it as safe as we can for the other person. We did get hit a number of times. It was scary. You're 10,000 miles from home.
Sure.
It wasn't as bad as places like Da Nang, but you were still in harm's way. Mail, well, there wasn't any internet. The mail was slow. It took 5-6 days. On our end, it was free. My local newspaper, the Asbury Park Press, I got to give them credit. They sent a free Sunday edition to any family member in Vietnam. You know, when other people are going through all kinds of riots and everything else and disparaging veterans, they did the right thing. And
right.
I have a great deal of respect for them. On my R&R, I met my girlfriend in Hawaii. That was great. The only thing that was sad about it, I sent her home a little bit before me by a few hours because I had an inkling. I'll never forget the scene because a lot of families came there with their kids, you know, to see their husband, whatever, and their kids. When it came time for us to board the plane back to Vietnam, I can't tell you the crying and some of these guys may not return.
Right.
Do that, and that's why I sent my girlfriend back home a few hours ahead of time. I'll never forget that scene. I mean, I can't tell you what I had for lunch 3 days ago, but I remember that scene. That'll stick in my mind forever.
Sure.
It's something that only if you've been there, I think you can understand.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was my father was a postal clerk for 42 years. The military post office was next to the weather station. So when the mail would come in, these guys, you know, I got to talk to them. I knew my father was a retired postal clerk. They would bring me my mail in person, which was nice. It was nice on their part.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, on the other side, my parents, when they would get mail from me, the postal clerk that delivered the mail in Asbury Park, I knew my father was retired postal clerk. He used to bring it up personally. You know, that was nice of him whenever, you know, there was a letter from Vietnam.
Sure.
My parents did not talk about my service in Vietnam. Not that they were ashamed of it, but there was a lot of harassing calls. When some of these anti-war groups got a hold of information that such and such was serving in Vietnam, families would get harassing calls.
Mm.
I mean, this is part of the legacy of the Vietnam War,
right.
Where you still have, and this was about 3 months ago, I was watching a commentator on CNN, somebody that was an instructor at a university was saying, I still believe the real heroes of the Vietnam War were the college students. Huh. I was getting ready to be scraped off the wall.
Sure.
These people had no idea. And towards the end of my tour, there was other things that went on there that were interesting, too. We got called in for a special briefing with a unit out of Kirkland Air Force Base that was involved in Air Force munitions. They showed us a picture of something we would be briefing on. It was called Commando Vault. They strapped 10,000-pound bombs that were originally designed for the B-36 bomber in the back of C-130s.
Mm.
You drop them in the middle of a forested area, and it flattens everything. It looks like an atomic explosion.
Okay.
I think now they're calling them daisy cutters, but that's
right.
What they call the commando vault in Vietnam. You would have an instant helicopter landing pad for two helicopters in the middle of a forested area in Vietnam.
Okay.
My understanding later was that these C-130s would fly a bombing mission in the morning, and in the afternoon they would fly cargo. So these guys were doing double duty.
Right.
It was a little spooky for me because I was privileged to secret information. Not only were the 10,000 bombs at Cameron Bay, but there's other stuff that I can't talk about that's still classified.
Sure.
If one of those bombs went off, you could have sent me home in an envelope.
Mm.
It was a bit scary.
Sure.
It was Commando Vault, and, like I said, it was all this secret stuff going on. Everybody had their own, little war that was, again, I had a privilege to actually, hit on this. And the other thing we did at Cameron, we were a port of entry, a number of weather officers that would go into other parts of the country. It was my job to meet them, get them temporary quarters. We had a tailor shop on base. If they didn't have jungle fatigues, get them a set of jungle fatigues. The Vietnamese would sew on their insignia. One, we had to bring it back because the Vietnamese sewed it on upside down.
Right.
But it was nice to see them, and we would talk on the phone. Some of them I went to tropical weather school with, so there was a bit of a personalities there. One guy that I went to tropical weather school and helped get set up, he went to the weather central at Tonson Oud. He later on was one of the three Air Force forecasters that's mentioned in Thor's Legion.
Okay.
That made the forecast for the Iran rescue raid that got hit by the snowstorm, dust storm.
Right.
He got cleared from that. They decided it was not the military forecaster's fault, what happened with the mission. But I'm sure that ended his career with them, with the Air Force.
Still
didn't look good.
Sure.
I'm certain it wasn't his fault. He was cleared. The other thing is, again, being a minority, Jews make up only 2% of the population. There weren't a huge amount of Jewish people in Vietnam. A lot of technical service, medicine, lab, things like that.
Okay.
So a lot of people didn't know what to make of me. I worked very hard. I understood that I would probably be the first one that they met.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to make a good impression. I did have a couple officers come up to me and say, "I want you working for me after the war." They liked my work habits.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, this is documented, interestingly, in two books that I'm willing to, if you don't have them, I'm willing to turn over to your archives.
Okay,
this
great.
It really isn't covered real well. Jungle Jews of Vietnam.
Okay.
It was printed in 1993, and a fascinating book called Saigon to Jerusalem about interviews with 18 American Vietnam War veterans that were so disgusted by the treatment they got as returning veterans to the United States. They took citizenship in Israel. Most of them served in the Israeli Army.
Hmm.
Interesting story because I had a similar experience, but I wasn't interested in going to Israel, even though my sister had lived there for a couple of years.
Okay.
So again, I wouldn't say an oddball, but people did a double take when they looked at my name tag.
Right.
Interestingly enough, there were among the POWs, there were three were in North Vietnam were Jewish, where two were mentioned in Jungle Jews of Vietnam.
Okay.
One was a backseater in an F-4. And retired eventually as a lieutenant colonel. The other one was a pararescue man that, as an enlisted man, he tried to save a downed pilot and was captured in the process. Him, he survived. The president gave enlisted men that were POWs in North Vietnam direct commissions. They made him an officer.
Mm-hmm.
He eventually became a pilot, retired as a major.
Okay.
Unfortunately, this Jungle Jews of Vietnam didn't mention the third guy, which is a real sad story.
Mm.
Alan Brudno was a graduate of MIT, was a backseater, and an F-4, was shot down in 65. He had a high technical degree from MIT. He wanted to become an astronaut.
Okay.
He was captured, was in there for 7.5 years. There was some allegations that the Vietnamese were helping the Arabs at that time. I believe that during the Yom Kippur War, some of the North Vietnamese pilots were flying for the Arabs when they were starting to run short.
Mm.
They singled out some of the Jews for particular treatment for that reason. But in a bizarre twist, which I wasn't real happy about, and I'll send you a copy of it, in 1946, Ho Chi Minh became real friendly with David Ben-Gurion, the founder of Israel.
Right.
He offered him a state in exile in Vietnam when the British were giving him a hard time.
Right.
Now, Shimon Peres last month greeted the first Vietnam ambassador to Israel, and he complimented, you know, how courageous the Vietnamese were and all that. I wasn't real happy about that.
Sure.
And I did write the editor a letter, and they kind of glossed it over and said, well, he wasn't commenting on who was right or wrong. He just said, you know, the Vietnamese were a courageous fighter. I wanted to throw up. I don't care.
Right.
Anyhow, just my point. Anyhow, Brudnell returned, and he was in such mental anguish that 4 months later he committed suicide.
Mm.
Eventually, through the efforts of his brother, it was felt, look, this guy was a POW for 7 years. That was, you know, how shall we say, induced as POW. They finally put his name up on the wall in 2004, the Vietnam Memorial War in Washington.
Right.
So, again, you know, a lot of people said none of the Jews went and all this. Like I said, we're 2% of the population.
Right.
A lot are college educated.
Mm-hmm.
So just like Vice President Cheney and other people, they took their deferments in some cases. In
right.
some cases, they didn't. But, you know, they're considering our percentage of the population. When you can see these $2, there were a number of deaths and a lot of anguish went on.
Mm-hmm.
I decided, you know, I had one last assignment. I was assigned to Blytheville Air Force Base, which was bizarre. After being in a war zone, I went to a SAC base, which closed now.
Okay.
Johnny Cash grew up a few miles from Blytheville. That gives you an idea of the country it was.
Right.
Not a lot to do in the town. Still better than Vietnam. I mean, you could go to a restaurant anytime you wanted to. You know, you weren't restricted from that.
Right.
But it was a SAC base, and there were, like, you know, all your I's got to be dotted, your T's crossed. And after coming from a war zone, I mean, I didn't have an attitude problem, but, you know, what is this?
Right.
And it was interesting because they had a very sophisticated weather radar. But, you know, then I got my discharge out of there and was going back to grad school. I felt now was the time to do it because if I had a master's degree, I wanted to work for the government, you know, I'd get a higher salary.
Sure.
So the meteorology department at Rutgers, the professor, Ed Havens, had been a weather officer in World War II, was recalled during Korea, and he was still a reserve major in the Air Force. So he was sympathetic. You know, you know, we'd like you to share your experience with us. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, he was very helpful and respectful. But he did tell me, with all the stuff going on there at the College of Agriculture, the faculty was so upset with the anti-war activity and the harassment of ROTC that some of the faculty was shaving off the Rutgers part of their parking sticker because they didn't want their neighbors to know they worked there.
Mm-hmm.
They were so embarrassed about, you know, the shenanigans going on.
Right.
They wanted to throw ROTC off campus, which would have been a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
They did it at Princeton. Basically, from my understanding, I think Rutgers is one of the few colleges in New Jersey that has an Air Force and Army ROTC program because all the others threw theirs off. And
right.
What they do is they allow people from other colleges to enroll in ROTC at Rutgers, but it's easier said than done.
Sure.
You go to Monmouth College down the street here in West Long Branch, it's a 45-minute trip to Rutgers,
mm-hmm.
in, you know, under non-rush hours. So you really have to do a hardship to try to get enrolled. I mean, it's there, but it's not like having it on campus. But I got to give Rutgers credit. They've still maintained their ROTC.
Right.
I had some harassment from professors. I had... I couldn't believe what I was hearing. You know, they would ridicule veterans in some of their classes, not on the Ag School,
okay.
but on the main campus. I also had harassments at the Graduate Student Center from one student in Malaysia, was giving me crap about Vietnam. I mean, this is, I'm not saying we were 100% right, but when you see people coming to this country for the education and putting the United States down,
right.
to me that's a bad guess.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, and some of the students, too, you know, were snotty. I mean, I didn't throw it around, but sometimes we would get into discussions. And it was this holier than now, you know. I have a feeling that a lot of the war resistance was people that just didn't want to go. They didn't want to interrupt their careers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think what the United States did was wrong. I think that I still believe, regardless of people have argued about the domino theory, it would have been a signal to the Russians because we're undermanned compared to them in Europe.
I think
they would have tried something in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they would have tried to overthrow the governments in Thailand and the other places. And I think it was a signal to them, look, we're willing to tough this out. So, you know, I don't disagree with the war at all. The way it was fought, well, I'm not a military strategist. In meteorology, we have a thing called hindcasting.
Okay.
You know, when somebody puts out the wrong forecast after the event happens, they come back and they say, well, if you had done this, this, and this, and saw this, after the event happened.
Right.
And this is what I'm saying. A lot of this Vietnam War stuff is hindcasting.
Mm-hmm.
I actually met Curtis LeMay when he was running for president.
Mm.
He visited Cameron Bay. I actually had a chance to see him.
Okay.
And I have the feeling there was people in the Air Force that would have loved to have started a war with China, figuring that someday we're going to have to fight them. We might as well do it now. And on the horizon, I think some people are afraid that we're going to have a confrontation with them when the time is right.
Right.
On their grounds, not on ours.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the bottom line was it's still better than a nuclear war, and that's what Johnson had to deal with.
Sure.
In terms of job opportunities, because so many people getting out at the same time and the Air Force needing less weather officers, I was offered a regular commission in graduate school if I stayed in.
Okay.
But I saw the handwriting on the wall, and also they were sending some weather officers into missile silos because it was a surplus of them. So, I mean, I'm glad that I spent my time in the military. It was the adventure of a lifetime. I got to see and do things and meet people that I never would have met. But it also had a downside in terms of employment. I couldn't get a job with the government, even though I did a good master's thesis. The interview I had was really nasty with a well-known member of the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Institute. he eventually went to jail for molesting little girls.
Mm.
He's somewhat of an embarrassment, but he was downright nasty to me.
Right.
And, you know, all he had to say is, you know, Joel, you've had interesting experience. You know, it was nice meeting you. I don't know if you're fully qualified for this. I'll look, you know. Instead, he was snotty and nasty to me.
Mm.
And when jobs became so difficult, I took at that time what was called the PACE exam.
Okay.
For Social Security and Internal Revenue. I scored high.
Mm-hmm.
I had an interview with Social Security, and the first thing the interviewer said to me, well, you've been a captain in the Air Force. You wouldn't be good for this job. You guys are used to pushing people around. I couldn't believe what the hell I was hearing.
Sure.
I got totally disgusted. I joined the unit of the Jewish war veterans, and even them, there was a thing going on in our state about eliminating veterans' preference at the time. And they got up and they said, well, that's not going to affect us. We're all approaching retirement. I said, wait a minute. And they gave me a hard time.
Huh.
I couldn't believe it.
Sure.
So they said, all right, you get us a statement and we'll look at it and we'll think about it. And the guy that gave me a hard time was a municipal judge, no less. So, I went the route. I got the wording of what the bill in the legislature was and all this. They gave me lip service. They passed a resolution. Yeah, we're opposed to it. I lost interest in them. I'm sure that they've done some good things, but eventually I linked up with the Vietnam Veterans of America, and they're more much in tune.
Sure.
Their attitude is, look, we don't care if our organization eventually dissolves, but we'll do the best we can for all veterans, not just, one group. And they have. They've done reasonable. I changed fields, went back to a community college, got a degree in respiratory therapy, even though I maintained my professional membership in the American Meteorological Society.
Okay.
And I was a registered respiratory therapist for 20 years. Then I became sick. People thought I had tuberculosis. And it turned out it wasn't that. It was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma from Agent Orange.
Okay.
And my doctor stood up for me, and she fought for me, and the VVA told me, what needed had to be said on the doctor's report. So first they gave me a hard time. They said I'd be fine. And when I went back for a re-exam and I went into everything that was going on, not only did I end up with 100%, but I ended above that for something else that I acquired as a result of the Agent Orange exposure.
Hmm.
So by being so hard-ass, the VA ended up, paying more than they would have if they hadn't insisted on putting me through the ringers.
Right.
But I paid a price. My wife and I are separated now, but I raised her two stepdaughters, and one still lives with me rather than, their father was never involved with them. I used my VA money to put the older one through college, and I bought the younger one a car, and I've helped her financially and stuff. We're still on friendly terms, but part of it was the illness. Was she just, even though she's a nurse, she, didn't want to deal with the stuff. It's like I said, it's been a long journey. The other thing that I acquired is when I became sick, I said, I deserve a degree from Texas A&M.
Mm-hmm.
So I contacted the American Meteorological Society. They contacted Texas A&M, contacted my congressman. They went through the records. The deal was this. Texas A&M eased up on the requirements, and I guess the state of Texas,
okay,
on what you need to get a BS. And they also gave credit. As I said, you needed 6 credits in political science, 6 credits in history. But what they did, they eased up on the requirements over the years, and they give you 3 credits for ROTC, 3 credits for military service. What they came up with was between the American Meteorological Society, my Congressman Rush Holt, and Texas A&M was, we'll give you the degree if you take a 3-credit course in political science and a 3-credit course in history from Southwest Texas, which they offer correspondence, which I did. And after I did, I sent them a copy of a letter from because the Air Force denied that anybody was received degrees for the program, unless somebody had graduated from Texas A&M in another field and then, you know, was commissioned and went through the weather program there as well. That's the only exception. I produced a letter from Dr. John Dutton, head of the meteorology department at Penn State at the time, and he noted that every one of the Air Force people in the air in the weather officer program got BS degrees. They arranged their program. So I got an apologetic letter from the provost at Texas A&M. He hit a panic button, apologizing, and he says, well, I see you've completed your 6 credits and you're getting a degree.
Right.
So I'm on a list there. As of December of 2001, they gave me a BS in meteorology.
Right.
And I'm a member of their Association of Former Students, and I even have a Texas A&M ring. The reason I did it is because Rutgers, there was a lot of hard feelings. Not the Ag School. They were good people. But there was a lot of stuff that went on there that just wasn't right and I wasn't happy about. Texas A&M has their muster. When I pass on, which may not be too much longer, they do remember you. And they trained me well, so I felt it was important that I be a member of them, even though I did it by correspondence. I'm also a member of Alpha Zeta, which is a honorary agricultural society similar to Phi Beta Kappa. You have a chapter there at Texas Tech, and in Texas the other chapter is at Texas A&M. But again, I'm glad that I'm a part of Texas A&M. I'm proud of the degree that I'm a part of Texas. You know, it played an influential role in my development as a weather officer, and I didn't want it to be forgotten.
Sure. All right. Okay. Well, before we wrap things up, I do have some questions for you, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Let's see. First of all, how did you become interested in weather to begin with?
Well, because my parents never owned a car, and I had to walk to school. Nobody was going to pick me up, you know, when it was raining or if it was raining. So I was always interested in what the weather was going to be because I needed how to dress. There wasn't going to be anybody there to, you know, to pick me up. And I walked everywhere. My parents didn't have a car. I, you know, generally got around by public transportation.
Mm-hmm.
So I was more attuned to what was going on, you know, because I had to. And my father, even though he only had an 8th grade education, was always interested in the weather, too, because he didn't have a car, and he had to be prepared. And it's ever since I was a little kid, that's since I was about 7 or 8 years old, that's what I wanted to do. And I would take out all the weather books out of, you know, our local library and read up as much as I could. And a school trip, we went to the Hayden Planetarium in New York City.
Okay.
And I bought a nice little book, which I still have now. It was written by a former weather officer, Robert Moore Fisher, called How to Know and Predict the Weather. It's one of the nicest weather books I've ever read. Even though it's yellowing, it's still among my treasured possessions.
Oh, sure.
It also kept me in school, too.
Right.
I had a goal. I knew what I wanted to do. And the same with the military. I knew what I was going to be doing after graduation, and a lot of people were floating. You know, they didn't, they were either trying to figure out how to get out of the draft or, you know, well, you know, I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. And again, the Air Force gave me the opportunity to be a weatherman, and not only that, to participate in weather forecasting in a military situation.
Mm-hmm.
Which I had read about as a kid, the forecast for the D-Day invasion.
Okay, right.
A lot of that stuff is really interesting.
Sure. All right. Okay. How about, you talked about this a little bit, but how about the military itself, the military aspect of it? Were you interested in that as a kid as well? Or?
Yeah, I mean, you know, everybody had to be concerned about the military because the draft was still in effect.
Right.
And you had to figure out how you were going to meet your obligation. Now, my parents wanted me to go to college, and I wanted to go, too.
Right.
But if for some reason, you know, I couldn't go to college, my route would have been either the Navy aerography program, which is what the Navy calls their meteorologists, you know, they call them aerographers, or going into the Air Force as an enlisted man into weather. I think, again, depending upon age, anybody who was of college age in the early 60s, you know, it was a concern of how do you meet your military obligation type of thing. It's my thing that I told people that dropped out of ROTC after 2 years. I said, look, what's 4 years if you enjoy what you're doing? And experience, too. Unfortunately, you know, we're told when we went into the military as officers, people are going to want you because you lead men, you're organized. That fell apart after Vietnam. That did not count. It counted internally in the way I handled people as a supervisor, as a respiratory therapist.
Okay.
I was a respiratory therapy supervisor in a hospital I worked at, in that I was much more adept at handling people as opposed to people that just went to a community college and were elevated to supervisor. World of difference in the way you deal with people.
Okay. All right. Speaking of the issue of military obligation and all that, did you have any relatives that had served in World War II?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I...
Hello? 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 Right. Okay, well, whenever I heard a click, I had just asked you if you had any relatives that had served in World War II.
Yes, I did, and this was the difference between, this was part of the problem with Vietnam. My mother had three brothers, and they all actually served. The first one was let out early because he had a medical condition, but the other two, her brother George, I had worked with for 3 years in high school. I worked on weekends with him.
Okay.
He had been in the Army. He was actually one of the first people drafted from 1940 to 1945. He was a master sergeant. He was the brightest one in my mother's family. I actually saved his letters. He was originally in the Army Chemical Corps, and then he served with Mark Clark in the invasion of North Africa.
Oh, wow, okay.
And in Sicily, like I say, I still have his letters and his pictures. He died young. He died when he was 49.
Mm.
He used to tell me stories, you know, all the time, interesting stuff. And her younger brother was also drafted and was fought in the Battle of the Bulge, and I still have some of his letters, but he dropped out of high school, so the level. He never talked about his World War II experiences. His brother talked about it all the time, and a lot of the people that he that I delivered to as customers were also, you know, in World War II.
Okay.
And this is the thing that I brought out to people, that during World War II, everybody had a son, a father, a brother, maybe even a sister that had served. Vietnam was much more selective. It was not as universal, and a lot of people just couldn't relate to it for that reason. The things that were done on campus and to veterans that were done during Vietnam would have been unexcusable in World War II.
Sure.
And this also, most my relatives were not in the military during Vietnam. A few distant ones were.
Okay.
And either one that had connections to get a medical excuse, the other that was extremely athletic when the time went to go for his military physical, he had a tricked knee. I was the only one in my family ever to be an officer, too, so that somewhat set me apart. My mother's family was good to me. They sent me packages. I never went to the Jewish religious services. I didn't feel that it was right. If I'd been out in the field, it was different. They, during Passover season, would send me, you know, a box of matzahs and a tin of macaroons. That was fine.
Okay.
If I had been out in the field, it would have been different. But we were shorthanded, so
sure.
I feel that the job that I was doing is more important. But if I had been out sleeping in a tent in the bush, I would have, you know, made an effort.
Right, right. Okay. All right. Let's see. I'm kind of, if it's all right with you, I'm kind of going through, as you were telling your story, I was writing down some questions, so
sure.
The questions I have are kind of in chronological order, but not quite. I may skip around a little bit
that's fine.
When you were talking about the teach-ins and stuff at Rutgers, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that. If you could tell me a little bit about what types of things, say, like, if you could elaborate a little bit more about what types of things they were saying about the war.
Well, what it was in a auditorium.
Okay.
I believe in one case it was a gymnasium, in one case it was in a classroom, a rather large grouping of students and professors, and even some townspeople that were somewhat angry about the whole thing.
Okay.
They were discussing the history of Vietnam, Americans' involvement, you know, what should or should be not be done. It was mostly a academic discussion of America's involvement in Vietnam and whether this was the correct or incorrect thing to do. And of course, Professor Genovese, who was a Marxist, but he didn't, one of my friends graduated number one at Rutgers, was a Henry Rutgers scholar.
Okay.
And he had him for a professor. He said, and other people said, he never brought his views about Vietnam or, you know, into the classroom. I do have to give him credit for that.
Sure.
His remarks were insensitive, of course, because there were Rutgers graduates that were fighting and dying in Vietnam, as well as local people.
Right.
Later, much later, he admitted he was wrong. This is like, you know, 30 years later.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting. I got to say, I didn't agree with some of the things that were said, but in terms of an academic environment, this is something that was happening as opposed to development of Western civilization or the history of the Civil War.
Right.
This was going on now, and it was being discussed by academians who were, how shall we say, well-versed in the history. I may not have, so it was interesting from that standpoint.
Sure.
It's just that I think Professor Genovese's marks were basically out of hand.
Right.
But he did say something that wasn't covered either, that was because I was there and I heard him say that. And what he said was, all you people jeering me, if you are so much in favor of the war, then why don't you take the place of all the blacks and Puerto Ricans that have been drafted and are dying over there?
Hmm.
Now, that wasn't quoted in the press, but I heard him say it.
Right. Okay. All right. How widespread do you think the anti-war movement was on campus?
At Rutgers, it was very widespread, but you have to understand that this is New Jersey. It's the Northeast.
Right.
You had more minorities coming to school, blacks, Puerto Ricans, foreign students as well, some who were anti-American or, you know, so you had this kind of element. Now, I have a friend from Texas A&M that was a weather officer that we go back and forth with.
Mm-hmm.
A&M was totally different. Mm. The president when I was there was Earl Rudder, who they said should have gotten the Congressional Medal of Honor for what he did on D-Day. Mm. And at A&M, they had a rally in support of the war. So this, you know, it wasn't universal. I think it was more concentrated on the East Coast, and, you know, the Northeast in particular, and on the West Coast, particularly at Berkeley. You know,
right.
Those were the two big hot areas of the anti-war movement, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. And you mentioned that at times it turned, I guess you could say, somewhat violent in the fact that that students attempting to burn down the Air Force ROTC buildings. Did you ever have, being in the Air Force ROTC, did you ever have any confrontations yourself?
At the time that I was there, there weren't confrontations.
Okay.
But After I left, there were confrontations where every year in the spring, military would hold like a ROTC would hold military review at the university at the Piscataway Stadium where Rutgers plays its football games.
Okay.
And there were disruptions, and of course the parents and families of kids that were in ROTC and who wanted to go in the military had some confrontations with the anti-war kids. As a matter of fact, when I was a graduate student at Rutgers, I met a weather officer at McGuire that was also had been a Rutgers student at the time and an AFROTC student. He said Air Force ROTC sent people into the community to try and smooth things over to say, you know, the whole university is not like that.
Right.
And that, you know, some of us support the military and our government, and we want you to know that the entire university is not that way. So at least AFROTC reached out, and fortunately Rutgers wanted to throw ROTC off campus. Fortunately, they backed down on that, but I know Princeton got rid of its ROTC programs. I believe Columbia did too. And that's a shame, because what you want in the military is you want a diversity of opinions. You don't want people coming from just one sector of the population.
Sure.
And again, it's a matter of how much longer we're going to be able to have a volunteer military.
Right.
It's broken. They're taking the same people and, you know, rotating them again and again. They're having mental and job problems from here on out. I certainly sympathize with them.
Right. Sure. Okay. Another question I have. You may have mentioned this. I can't remember. I'm sorry. But what were your dates of service in country?
It was from October 2nd of 1968 to October 4th of 69. I was supposed to go out on a Seaboard World Airlines charter flight, but they had a bad reputation. I was supposed to go out on October 2nd. Seaboard World had one of their military charter flights stray over China.
Oh, wow.
And it was forced down. They kept the people on the ground for 24 hours, and then they let them go. But when I saw that, we had people from the 14th Aerial Port, both Army and Navy, Army and Air Force officers. So I took it to them, and they said, give it to us. We'll get you on another flight.
Okay.
So they changed my flight. They could only make it for 2 days later to another charter airline, but I was not going out on Seaboard World, not after what they did. You know, they were fortunate that's all they were forced down. They could have been shot down, too. So,
right.
And they didn't have a real good reputation. So
sure.
I left 2 days later than I was supposed to.
Right. All right. Let's see. What else do we have? As far as the your detachment, it was the 18th to the 30th. Is that correct?
Detachment 18.
Okay.
30th Weather Squadron.
Okay.
And 30th Weather Squadron was all the Air Force detachments in Vietnam.
Okay.
They were there. The headquarters was considered Tonson Ut. The Army Weather the Air Force people assigned to the Army in Vietnam were under the 5th Weather Detachment.
Okay. All right. And as far as the Detachment 18's weather responsibility, was it the Cameron Bay area, or did it extend out further?
Well, it was basically our responsibility was Cameron Bay people that were operating in and out of there.
Okay.
But in terms of weather briefings, I mean, we were responsible for the weather briefing of aircraft going, you know, on missions over North Vietnam, Laos, South Vietnam, flying market time patrols out over the in the South China Sea, military cargo and aircraft flights to Okinawa, Yokota, Japan, Clark Air Force Base, Hickam Air Force Base, Hawaii. So So we, you know, it wasn't, we were just, I weren't narrowed there.
Okay.
We did use, you know, some, how should we say, maps and forecasts provided for by Weather Centrals, but we still had to prepare it and modify it for, you know, people going to those areas.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And you mentioned in the questionnaire, and I believe you mentioned as well earlier, that you were acting as the detachment commander at a point.
Yeah. The second commander I had, he was a great commander, but he had some family problems. He had to go on emergency leave for a month.
Okay.
And I had to act as not just chief forecaster, but as detachment commander as well.
Okay.
So I had to wear two hats. And interestingly enough, he had three kids. The one that got a letter of reprimand had eight kids.
Mm.
And he had them so well organized that his wife didn't have to get up in the morning.
Uh-huh.
So he ran basically his household better than he ran the detachment. The other guy ran the detachment great.
Right.
But he had problems with his household.
Okay. What type of additional duties did that entail for you?
It involved disciplining people.
Okay.
Provided writing letters. Basically, also, the guns were locked up in the detachment. So, you know, in case of we were infiltrated, you know, releasing the guns to the detachment. We would also sign out the guns when we left the base. My first commander was so afraid of getting killed, he sent me on an aircraft accident investigation up to the lot. So I took guns with me. Whenever I left the base, I was always armed.
Okay.
We weren't really trained very well. That's one of my objections. If it would have been up to me, there would have been a lot more retraining and proficiency going on in military weapons.
Sure. Okay. Speaking of weapons training, how much weapons training had you had at that point?
Not a lot. They gave me an hour on an M16 at Otis Air Force Base.
Okay.
And about an hour on a 45 pistol. I went to Boy Scout camp. As a matter of fact, the heroic prisoner of war, George Coker, was actually not only did he go to Camp Winnebago, where I went, up in northern New Jersey, in Marcella, New Jersey, he was not only there as a camper, he was an Eagle Scout. He was on staff there for two or three years. The camp story in the Camp Winnebago had mentioned that to me because his troop was sponsored by St. Elizabeth Church in used to be diagonally across from our synagogue. His was troop 32, we were 31. So
okay.
I asked, and sure enough, they mocked on him in a, I believe it was a movie called Hearts and Minds.
Right.
It was, they cut and pasted some of his return home to Linden, New Jersey as a hero after being a prisoner of war.
Right.
And they did it in such a way to make him look like a fool. I knew, I recognized the policemen and some of the people in the film clip. The guy was a hero. He actually escaped for 15 hours and, you know, he was tortured. The way they cut him apart made me want to puke.
Sure.
And again, this is a personal thing because he grew up in the town. And he was an Eagle Scout. He still was active in scouting after he was released, and he made a career out of the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
He was also a Rutgers student a year before me. He was supposed to graduate in 65, but left in 63 to go into the Naval Aviation Cadet Program. And he eventually, after he was released, he got his degree, I believe, from San Diego, somewhere out on the West Coast.
Right, okay. All right. Yeah, I remember, now that you mention it, I do remember seeing that section on him in the film. I know it's certainly a very controversial film and its take on the war.
And that's why I'm saying I'm an eyewitness to history because
sure.
Not only did I go to the scout camp probably the same time he was there, but
right.
He was on staff later on. And again, he went to Rutgers as well. as did Jack Jacobs, one of the two Jewish Congressional Medal of Honor winners. The other was Levitow, who he died of cancer. He's the one that was the Air Force enlisted man that in a C-47, I think it was, one of the grenades got loose and was burning. He jumped on it.
Mm.
And with his body, he was severely burned. He survived, but I think he died of cancer about 10 years ago. Mm. So.
Right. Right. Okay. Another thing that you had mentioned earlier, you talked about being in charge of a couple of captains when you were a lieutenant. I just wonder if you could say a little bit more about that, and how did they take to that?
They didn't care.
Okay.
They had an attitude problem. They were one guy. He was planning to kill my commander. I was really nervous. He had extended, and he was entitled to another R&R. And this is the commander that got the letter of reprimand. Wasn't going to give it to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was telling me exactly how he was going to do it.
Oh,
and I was nervous. I mean, this was the father of 8 kids.
Sure.
What he was going to do is he made friends with some of the Vietnamese across the on the mainland there, and they'd kill anybody for $50.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to invite them out to dinner and have the truck jumped and ambushed. Fortunately, he called the IG, and it was straightened it out. But I was nervous because,
sure.
You know, when push came to shove, I was getting ready to intervene, and it would have been a real touchy situation there.
Right.
Fortunately, he was serious about it, though. He was crazy enough that he would have he would have had it done.
Wow.
No question in my mind.
Right.
And I was on pins and needles.
Right.
Yeah, he was the chief forecaster, and he got fired because he didn't care. And the other two guys could care less. You know, it was, again, part of the thing was being the only Jewish guy in a detachment and probably the first one they ever met. I wasn't going to let him down. So I was going to do more than my job, because I'd probably be the first and last Jewish person they ever met up close.
Mm.
And this same guy, the one that was going to kill my commander, when he left, he shook my hand and said, "Joel, after the war, I want you working for me. I like you." There was a private beach that we weren't supposed to use.
Okay.
And he would go swimming there. He would take me with him. He says, "You can call for help." I said,
"Okay."
Finally, one day, he went swimming in a restricted area, and there was a shark sitting there. It scared the crap out of him. But he told me what his attitude was. Rules are made for 99% of the people. He said, "I'm the other 1%. I don't follow them."
Mm, wow.
Piece of work. But he was a graduate of one of the, not West Point, but he was a graduate of one of the military schools.
Okay.
And that's what spooked me. Some of these guys really, you know, were out in left field. The way they described their life, certain weekends they weren't allowed off the campus, the hazing that went on and stuff. To me, it's not a way to go to college. I don't care. You know, it doesn't expose you to real life.
Right. Okay. All right. I know you mentioned in the questionnaire that you had found that in some cases they weren't always, that the Air Force wasn't always sending, and I'm not trying to be, I'm not trying to criticize at all, but I believe you mentioned something about the Air Force not always sending the best personnel in the case of Vietnam and in Gulf War I. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
And this is outlined in this book, Thor's Legions.
Okay.
By John Fuller, and this is published by the American Meteorological Society.
Mm-hmm.
It was a matter of people that were intensively trained in tropical meteorology should have been running some of this stuff, and they weren't.
Okay.
It was a matter of punching a ticket, you know. Well, We need somebody to fill a slot in Vietnam for a year. All right, his name is up. We're sending him. The fact that my first detachment commander had done nothing but write computer programs for a number of years didn't make him very qualified to run a weather detachment, even though he was a major.
Okay.
But they didn't care. Part of the problem was the one-year tour. And I agree with that. You know, sending somebody to Vietnam for 2 or 3 years is stretching it. That was a morale factor. You knew that you were going to be there for a year. You counted down the days. But if you were there for the duration, I don't know. I'm not so sure. What they did offer was people that would extend by 6 months. They would offer them another R&R, and they would generally offer them any assignment they wanted out of Vietnam. And there were people, enlisted men that did it, to get out early. They would let them out early in addition. But people were starting to flip out after a year.
Yeah.
You know, you're starting to have mental problems. You were in isolation. You didn't, you know, the mail was slow. Communication was virtually impossible. There were some phones in Saigon, you know, that maybe you could call through. But it's not like with the internet with today where you can communicate daily back and forth.
Sure.
There was extreme isolation. Even the TV, it was just Armed Forces Vietnam Network. New York Times, I would read in the library. It was a week and a half old to get, you know, catch up on the news. And I did meet people over there. Interestingly enough, I met some Army guys on a shuttle bus between our Quonset hut and the weather station. They were coming back for their second and third tours. I says, aren't you, you know, your number's going to come up. You're playing with your chances.
Right.
The guy told me, he said, I got out of the Army. I went back to Louisiana. There was nothing for me in a small town. People didn't give a crap. Here I have good friends. I enjoy what I'm doing. It's an interesting life. So that's another way to look at it, too. And I know that there's books that have been written about Americans that went back to Southeast Asia because they didn't like the way they were treated in the United States.
Right.
A number of men, when they got older, you know, they'd go after younger women who would just laugh at them. They go over to Thailand, you know, young girl with an older man, that's perfectly okay.
Right.
And sometimes being somewhat less sophisticated when I was younger than some people, some of the old sergeants were funny. They would say to me, he said, well, after the war, I'm going to Thailand and work on the railroad. And, of course, being a train buff and written train books and histories, you know, I'm thinking to myself, well, what the hell? What's so great about the railroad in Thailand? And they say, yeah, I'm going to Thailand, work on a railroad, lay ties. It took me a little while to catch on.
Right, okay.
I mean, these guys were funny. I enjoyed the NCOs more than the officers. They had been around the world quite a bit. A lot of these guys had been in the service, got out, couldn't make it, went back in the service. They were a little bit of a cut-up, I guess, when they were, you know, younger, and it straightened them out. They were real interesting to talk to, the places they've been, the things they had dealt with. To me, that was like just as much as fascinating as being in the Air Force is learning about weather as talking to these guys. It was a real education.
Mm-hmm. Sure. All right. Another thing I wanted to ask you about, I know you talked about the typhoon, but were there other memorable weather phenomenon that happened that you could possibly talk about?
Well, actually, in our part of Southeast Asia, climatology and persistence were the two main tools.
Okay.
Once the monsoon started, the monsoon seasons, the temperatures were pretty steady.
Okay.
It was like during the northeast monsoon, high temperature would be in the high 80s. The low temperature would be in the high 70s, except if you were like in a up high or in a valley somewhere, then it would be different. I heard that up at the Lot, which was a really pretty place that I flew up on an aircraft accident investigation,
Okay.
It used to be a French resort, and there used to be an interesting cog railroad that ran from Fantiet, or it's actually called Tab Chop on the coast, about 30 miles south of Cameron, through the mountains into the lot. It actually would snow there every few years, just a few flakes.
Right.
And then, of course, during the southwest monsoon at Cameron, the temperatures would reach the high 90s and, the low temperatures be in the 80s. Very persistent. It just occasionally you would have disturbances in the atmosphere like a speed max, which was an area of, let's say, of 20 to 30 mile an hour winds up at 3,000 feet that would create a disturbance and a light rain shower.
Okay.
There was a thing called Kratchen, which was low ceilings and fogs that you expect, like sea fog in New England,
okay,
that would occur from basically Tuvalu would be a little bit farther south, basically from like about Phuket, north of Da Nang, up through North Vietnam, a front would hang up, and you would have low ceilings and fog. This wouldn't happen as far south as Cameron Bay, but the terminology for it was Kratchen.
Okay.
Also, you would have the burning of the rice throughout Southeast Asia in, I would say, around February and March. This would create haze problems, not so much at Cameron Bay, but inland along the mountains and stuff. When the sun got lower in the sky, the slant visibility would play havoc with some of the air missions. Winds, too, was another thing. Particularly at Cameron Bay, during certain of the monsoons, the winds would really pick up. The sand would be blowing like crazy. And they did issue us goggles. I did wear them once, I believe. Would cut into your eyes. It didn't happen that often, but when it did, you know, blowing sand. Very strange experience. On YouTube, there's a couple of videos on Cameron Bay, Now and Then.
Okay.
And one of them is, Cameron is now the civilian airport for Nha Trang. They closed the civilian airport in Nha Trang. They built a better road. It's still 20 miles away.
Okay.
There's a YouTube video of a Vietnamese jet airliner landing in Cameron Bay, and I got totally spooked out by it. I had nightmares of it.
Mm.
If you ever saw the movie 12 O'Clock High,
right,
Dean Jagger, first part of the movie, he walks across a runway that's overgrown, that's part of a pasture.
Okay.
Ooh, did I get that feeling. As the plane lands, the runway is there. They built a small, very small, modern air terminal, but all the buildings are gone.
Okay.
It's all overgrown with brush.
Huh.
Eventually, they want to redevelop it. It was like I had nightmares that following night after seeing it, getting off that plane and being left there with nothing. It's a strange feeling because the base was burgeoning with all kinds of buildings and military and airplanes, and all you see is scrub brush, mountains, water, and a small terminal and a long runway.
Wow.
Ghosts. I felt like I was stepping back into that scene at a 12 o'clock high.
Right.
It totally spooked me out.
Right.
Now, the Russians occupied it from 1979 to 2002.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, the C7A Caribou Association that I'm a member of, they were contacted by a Russian woman meteorologist, actually a meteorological technician,
okay,
that was stationed there with her husband in the 1990s and had a grand time there. Her and her husband are divorced now. She's an American citizen. To her, it was the time in her life.
Right.
And she'd love to go back there because it was peacetime. The life there was good. They ate well. They didn't have to worry about attacks. They had freedom to go wherever they wanted. To her, it was a paradise. To me, it's interesting, but I have no desire to go back. We've emailed back and forth some things.
Right.
We also found out that the Russian planes flying out of Cameron had dolphins on their tails. Now, the Americans, it came out later on, they had trained dolphins to attack VC swimmers at Cameron.
Huh.
I was thinking that some of the dolphins defected, but it turned out she told me the story, and I'll submit some of the stuff to you.
Okay.
That was the symbol. The dolphin was also the symbol of the Russian military unit from Sevastopol was stationed at Cameron, and it turns out they were doing the same thing the Americans did. After the war, they were training dolphins at Sevastopol to attack swimmers and do military intelligence work.
Huh.
So on the pennant that she emailed me, there's a mean-looking dolphin with a sword in its mouth. It ain't Flipper.
Right.
So it's a bizarre complete circle from the fact that my grandmother used to sing sad songs about the defeat of the Russian fleet that actually assembled at Cameron Bay.
Right.
To this Russian woman who's now an American citizen, actually Ukrainian, but she's an American citizen now, who was stationed there and had a great time as a meteorological technician. And I compared notes with her.
Right.
And, you know, she would love to go back there. Why? I don't care. I have no desire, none
right.
whatsoever.
Hmm. Right. That is certainly an interesting circle there. All right. You talked a little bit about the equipment that you had there. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about just what different types of monitoring systems you had for the weather.
Well, we had a weather radar. Uh-huh. I believe it was an FPS 105.
Okay.
It was what I'm told it was out of the nose of a 707. But it was still better than what we had at Otis Air Force Base, which was a set taken out of a B-17 that was totally useless. It was worthless. We could pick stuff out far out to sea. The problem was the mountains were within a mile or two of us, and that's what you call ground clutter. And that it was a problem picking up stuff that was, I guess you'd say west of us. But it was useful, but Thompson Newt had a CPS-9, which was sophisticated, and also Pleiku had a sophisticated weather radar, too. And I believe possibly some of the bases in Thailand may have had it. We did have fax, which meant that we got printed maps every couple of hours. We would also make up copies of maps as needed for different units on an Oslet machine. It was a primitive copy machine, but it worked, so, you know, we had it maintained. We had a pilot-to-forecaster radio so that pilots in the air could actually contact us and ask for a weather briefing, you know, as they were in the air. They would also ask us what field the condition was. There was certain alert levels. We weren't allowed to give that over the pilot to forecaster. There was a strange story that was recorded in Thor's Legion where we also had a recorded daily weather message that the Red Cross girls would do for morale factors. People could call up and get a general weather briefing. Da Nang had one too. Sometimes people also would call up the weather station with heavy Vietnamese accents.
Huh.
Now, they claim that they were getting information for the charter flights like Northwest Air and Pan Am. I assume they were. I'm not really sure. But they had a heavy Vietnamese accent. At Da Nang, that was going on too. And they couldn't figure out why the artillery... you know, they were hitting them with rockets and mortars, and they were pretty accurate. And then one day, they found out they were way off. And then the weather officer up there realized that the guy calling with the Vietnamese accent was calling from the VC to get winds and temperature readings for their mortars.
Huh.
And when he gave them the wrong information by accident, that was the day that they were off the party. So I'm not so sure that some of those phone calls that were made were really, I mean, they were real thick accents. You could hardly understand them. I know. I could have been given information to the wrong side. We did have a secure phone, though, for certain information, but some of the other information came over non-secure. The thing that was a little spooky was that there was a small window at the end of the Quonset hut of the weather station that we shared with base ops.
Okay.
But, you know, you were too busy to actually walk away from the weather station and look out at the window. So sometimes you would just take a walk outside just to make sure that what was reported was actually going on.
Right.
It's a strange feeling. You walk into a weather station, you know, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon sometimes, and it's bright sun outside. And you don't see any light for 8 hours, and you walk out at 11 o'clock, and it's pitch black, or vice versa.
Right.
It's a very strange feeling. It's almost like being in a blockhouse. And we're busy enough that you couldn't walk the 20 or 30 feet down to the plexiglass window to look out, you know, very often to see what the weather was just from your own observational point of view.
Right, sure. Okay.
And the other thing that was nice is that in tropical forecasting school, in the tropics, fronts and highs and lows are not really a tool that you deal with in the tropics in terms of weather movements and things like that. More applicable to the northern part of North Vietnam, yes, but not South Vietnam and Thailand.
Okay.
You mainly deal in the analysis of winds, winds at lower level, speed maxes, easterly waves, neutral points, cyclonic winds, anticyclonic winds. I still, to this day, could analyze. I would know how to do it. It stuck with me. The fact that I kept the weather diary, too, I put it in a drawer for a long time. I thought maybe I might use it for a graduate degree. My graduate degree was in satellite meteorology. It had nothing to do, really, with Vietnam. And I pulled it out after all those years. It refreshed my memory about a lot of things. I wrote explanations in it. One of the people that wrote the weather discussion out of Tonsonut had been my instructor at Tropical Weather School at Chinook Air Force Base, so it was interesting. He was Captain Lavin at the time. He retired as a colonel. And I would make notes of that in my diary. It was a different aspect of weather. There's a copy of it in the National Archives, and there's a copy of it in the Air Weather Service History Office. And it's online. The Caribou Association put it online, but I had it printed up for your records, too, so that it's you know, easy to get to and understand. It's something very different, and every time I look at it, it spooks me because I remember exactly what was going on. I'm glad that I kept it. I didn't, you know, the original diary, I had some other things. I had a girlfriend at the time. When the Air Force asked me for it, I said, I can't give you the original for that reason. He said, well, copy it. So I covered over those sections of the diary that I wrote in that were personal.
Right.
But the weather stuff, you know, they have both my typed version and the original.
Oh, okay.
You know, handwritten.
All right. Let's see. Another thing I wanted to ask you about. If you could talk a little bit about just your impressions of the Vietnamese.
Well, fortunately at Cameron Bay, there wasn't that much exposure. We had them as like cleaning ladies.
Okay.
They were pleasant. I mean, some of the younger girls spoke English. Well, you really never knew anything about them or which side they were on. Vietnamese troops, the little experience I had with them, not too disciplined. When I went to visit my friend up at Da Nang, the Army aerial port officer escorted me to the plane. He was a big guy. And these two little Vietnamese, about half my size, enlisted men, just cut in front of me and ran on the plane. You know, they were in uniform.
Right.
He looked like he was going to take them together and rub their heads together on the ground. I was pissed, but, you know, hey, I'm not going to make a big deal of it. My little impression was that a lot of them weren't too well disciplined. I know one of the other Army aerial ports officers that was he had been at Banmi Tuat for 6 months and was wounded. And
okay.
As a reward, they gave him a cushy job as an aerial port officer.
Okay.
He hated the Vietnamese. He claimed he got to hold a gun to their head to get them to fight. But, of course, the war was going on there, you know, for years there. And some of them had relatives fighting on both sides. You know, I understood that.
Right.
What I will say, the Vietnamese women that worked in the kitchen, they said, by eating American food, they gained on the average of, like, you know, 20, 30 pounds right away.
Right.
Their kids were cute, but, again, we didn't have very much contact with them. We know that you couldn't get Coca-Cola at the BX. For some reason, they either bribed somebody or stole it. They had little stands on base where you could get it from the Vietnamese, but you could never get it, you know, at the lower price at the base exchange. So either there was some graft going on, or, you know, who knows, you know, what kind of stealing was going on. But Cameron, there was only a few small villages, you know, along and near the base. Some of the Army guys had contact, were friendly with the girls. Some actually got in trouble. They were found sleeping with their hooch maids and were told, you know, get rid of your hooch maid or you're going out in the field. This is not a bad assignment. And some of them, you know, the Army pulled the raid and said, we warned you, bye-bye, you're, you know, going out into the field.
Right.
But again, my, you know, I didn't touch base with them until much years later. I met a Vietnamese doctor when I was working at a community hospital in New Jersey.
Okay.
That couldn't afford to re-go through med school, had been put through a re-education camp in Vietnam because he was on the wrong side. Finally got out, but, you know, he went to nursing school in America so he could have a profession. And he was doing his rotation at the hospital. We got to talking, very nice, very pleasant. I gave him a book of Vietnam that I had gotten and I didn't want anymore. He was appreciative. He was very nice. I also watch, I get a kick out of CNN, Betty Nguyen.
Right.
She actually graduated from the University of Texas, I believe. And her father was a American serviceman, her mother Vietnamese, and he was living in Vietnam, and he, I think when she was 6 years old, he was lucky to get them out on a C-130. When I was there, I didn't have very much contact with the Vietnamese. My feeling was there was a culture gap.
Right.
The other very strange thing is when I was filling sandbags under a mountain, when we were increasing our sandbag protection of our Quonset hut, you had the feeling that there was a presence there in a mountain. I know the Vietnamese, in some sense, worshipped their ancestors.
Uh-huh.
I can tell you there was a presence there in the mountain. I'm not talking about VC.
Okay.
I've never had that feeling in any other place before, but there is something to that.
Right.
Those Vietnamese that came to the United States, I think, you know, they're appreciative. I respect them. They've worked hard. Asians in general are a hardworking group. But at the time of the war, again, I think during World War II, Americans had more of a closer association with the British and French. The Vietnamese was an alien culture.
Right.
So it was, you know, and Cameron being what it is, I didn't have to contact the people who were in Saigon or in Nha Trang, you know, who lived in hotels and all that. They obviously, you know, had more day-to-day contact. I had the day-to-day contact with the hooch maids and stuff.
Right.
Most of them were older women, and again, you know, there was no intellectual discussion or anything like that. Again, you didn't know what they did when they went home at night. You know, they might have given intelligence to their friends.
Right.
You just don't know.
Right, sure. Okay. What about civic action programs. Did you or anyone within your unit?
Well, I was asked to, there was a Love of the Cross orphanage that some of the junior officers were involved in. But truthfully, I was working 6 days a week.
Right.
And the other thing is, hey, you know, I don't know whose side these people are on. I'm not about to risk my neck.
Sure.
It's different if I was continuously out in the field. So I declined the offer, plus the fact it was, I'm not a Christian. I was not that comfortable in that kind of situation. I'm going to be totally alien to them. So I just politely declined. But there was some Air Force officers that were involved in that. We had a Baptist minister living up in our Quonset hut with us, and he was, you know, he looked after me. He mentioned about, you know, when the Jewish services were and where I could go, and I appreciated it. It was nice of him. But again, you know, I was not out in the boonies, and my relatives were pretty thoughtful for me when it came to the holidays and stuff.
Right.
I was appreciative of that.
Okay. All right. Well, how would you spend your downtime when you weren't on duty? It sounds like you're pretty busy over there, but when you did have
really, I basically, I liked the library. They had a pleasant little library. Pretty Vietnamese girl, who was kind of classy, maintained it. Mm-hmm. Never, hardly anybody in the library. Was able to read the New York Times, was, it was usually a week and a half old, some books. It's just a pleasant place to escape. The BX, usually the BX on cameras and expensive watches and stuff, they had, people had advance notice. It's usually gone within a day.
Okay.
Couldn't understand why people would buy expensive stereo equipment, you know, particularly being in Vietnam with the sand and the moisture, but I guess I figured they had nothing to spend their money on. I had just had a cheap Instamatic. I did take a couple of pictures, but I couldn't see the sense of buying an expensive camera. That, you know, with the heat and the moisture, you know. We had a officer's club annex. Was really nice. Was built up on top of a hill right by our Quonset hut. It served food on, I believe, like 2 days a week. You could get a steak and a baked potato and, you know, beer. And it would be a nice way, if I wasn't working hours that conflicted, have a supper over the South China Sea, you know, cloud flicking, straight out of South Pacific. There are times that I felt like I was living South Pacific. And in South Pacific, Bloody Mary is a Tonkinese. That was a name for the northern Vietnamese that the French used to use, interestingly enough.
Right.
And the woman that played Bloody Mary was a native of Keyport, New Jersey.
Where
my best friend is involved with the Historical Society. But I always halfway felt I was living out two movies, South Pacific, although it didn't have the women. There were Red Cross girls, but some hard feelings with them. Some of them tended to go after the pilots, and, you know. And the other movie, which was ironic, that I saw the first week, I believe, I was on the campus of Rutgers, one of my favorite movies, Bridges at Toko Ri. Very haunting movie. And I didn't realize that in a few years I would be sort of living that one out, too. Which makes it hard to relate to people my age that didn't go, family members that didn't go. I mean, I'm in a totally different world. What's important, what isn't. I've experienced things completely different, you know, than they'll ever experience.
Sure. Okay. Another thing, you alluded to the aircraft accident investigation a few times. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that and what actually happened.
Well, in this case, apparently C-130 was damaged on landing at the lot.
Okay.
The lot, like I said, was in the center of the country. Was in the time of the French, was a a resort. They used to hunt tigers up there. It's still popular because with a, you know, particularly in the heat of the summer, it's up in the mountains. It's cooler. It's pleasant. And anyhow, my commander was supposed to go. They wanted to find out if there was any weather element involved in the crash. So he chickened out of going. He told me I'm going, and I said, fine. So I went across the field to the C-130 unit. They flew me up there. They said, you know, if I gave a good enough report, they'd give me a free trip to Yokota Air Base in Japan. Well, you know, I knew better. My thing was not to hang the guy. You know, my thing was just to report what effect, you know, weather might have had.
Right.
And, you know, I got up there, and I saw right away that there was terrain effects. The weather was good. I mean, it was not a matter that it was in a rainstorm or, you know, in heavy winds or anything. The air crew alluded to me that the pilot was kind of a screw up, but I wasn't going to take the, you know, that wasn't fair to take into consideration. I spoke to the weather observer up there, and I noticed in coming in, we were over like almost evergreen vegetation. It went from evergreen vegetation to a hot, dusty runway, and I could feel, you know, what happens when you have a situation like that. You have strong updrafts and downdrafts.
Okay.
You have downdrafts over the cooler green area where there isn't as much heating. You, when you come over an open area where, you know, there's a big difference, you have thermals that are forced the air up. So you kind of, depending on how bad it is, you hit like a bump. You go from all of a sudden something forces you up. Generally, a good pilot's going to compensate for that, but again, it's something to be considered.
Right.
When we got back, they, you know, questioned me, and I said, well, you have, you know, thermals there that definitely would affect a pilot on landing. Well, how much would it force the plane down? And I told them, I said, I'm not an aeronautical engineer. I said, you're going to need an aeronautical engineer. Well, give us an estimated guess. Well, I'm not about to hang the pilot on my estimated guess.
Sure.
I'm saying, again, you're going to have to talk to an aeronautical engineer. I said, I can't, you know, all as I can tell you is what I felt coming in, what I saw there, what I observed. I said, you definitely have, you know, updrafts and downdrafts because of the change from heavy green, deciduous green vegetation, which is going to be cooler than coming up on a heat island of a runway in the middle of this green lush vegetation.
Okay.
And they kept on pressing me, and I said, I can't tell you. And they finally backed off. Later on, of course, I guess I felt my testimony wasn't convincing enough, but so I didn't get the trip, and I didn't care about that. But they said an aeronautical engineer did figure out that, you know, what it was, but it wouldn't affect his landing. I don't know what the end result was, but, you know, all I'm going to tell them is just what I saw, what I felt, what it might do to the plane, that the weather in terms of, you know, the weather was clear in terms of wind. There was no rain. There was no thunderstorm. But the updrafts and downdrafts obviously would have had an effect. But it's the job of an aeronautical engineer to figure that out.
Right.
And that was the end of that. I will say, on the flight up there, it was one of those days, sea forever weather. I couldn't believe it. I mean, you know, most of the time I'm confined to the base. I did make some aerial trips to other places in Vietnam. But I couldn't believe the scenery. The Gordon McGee, I believe his name was, has a poem called High Flight.
Okay.
He was, a British or Canadian fighter pilot killed in World War II. And his poem is famous, and in there's a line about him flying and being able to reach out, touch the face of God. I swear to God, on that day, looking out of that plane on the way to Dalat over those mountains, you could see clear to Cambodia.
Oh, wow.
Off miles in the distance, not a cloud in the sky.
Right.
Had no feeling that I was in Vietnam anymore, and I came the closest I ever felt to actually holding your hand out, touching the face of God. I mean, that poem came alive to me that day.
Right.
So that was one of the odd, interesting things about that aircraft accident investigation.
Sure.
The other, it's unfortunate that the Cog Railway doesn't exist anymore. It used to be a nice, that I would travel back to Vietnam to ride on. A Cog Railway is a railway for the mountains. They're more common in, like Switzerland has perfected it. As a matter of fact, they bought two of the old engines from the Cog Railway from Vietnam. I've gone on the internet and seen pictures of them going back to Switzerland. I actually have some materials to make a little scale model of it. I'm always curious of, I'm a pretty good model builder, and I have pictures of it. What happened was the French built it in the 1930s. It was in service to 1964. The North Vietnamese claimed the Americans destroyed it. Americans didn't destroy it. The VC were sabotaging it.
Okay.
When the Vietnamese reunified Vietnam, they tried to remove all the rails to put it on the main system that runs along the coast from Da Nang to Saigon, and they destroyed it. They ripped everything up. It turns out the rails were a different type. They were for a different type train than was used on the coastal line. Now they want to rebuild it. They feel it would be a great tourist asset, but its price tag is $15 billion. Interestingly enough, when I was in Vietnam, they were getting Trains magazine at the VX, and they had a two-part article, which I still have, on Vietnamese railways, which was interesting.
Okay.
The Vietnamese term for train translates into the conveyance which runs by fire.
Huh.
And I've gone on to sites, and even though the Vietnamese railway service is much better now, and you can actually go from Ho Chi Minh City or Saigon to Hanoi, you know, without getting blown up, some of the stuff, they supposedly modernized it, but... I've seen pictures of urine-stained sheets on the trains.
Right.
I mean, they've modernized their equipment, but I don't think it's anything like American trains, even though, you know, they show pictures of upgraded equipment and stuff. It is relatively slow, and it's not a journey in my health that I would even try to make, but
right.
It is one of the interesting aspects of Vietnam, that railway runs right along the coast for many miles. And, of course, during the Vietnam War, only small sections of it operated. There was a train that used to run. I never saw it, but it ran from near Phan Rang up to Nha Trang.
Okay.
There's pictures of it in Trains Magazine, too. But, again, today they don't have to worry about bombings and stuff. So
sure.
It's, you know, under a different type of system.
Right, right. Okay. All right, just a few more questions for you. That's all right. Some of the interesting things that you mentioned in the question here that I wanted to ask you about, you talked about receiving information, being briefed about how to handle possible defecting enemy planes.
Yeah, that when I was acting detachment commander, I couldn't believe the letter that came down.
Uh-huh.
It was that letter and another letter, which I can't discuss, about
sure.
things that were being stored at Cameron Bay.
Okay.
But, yeah, it was, I can't remember the exact procedure, but it was a single-page letter outlining procedures, what to do with a defecting plane or pilot. Now, I had no idea whether the CIA was planning to get somebody to defect or... maybe they thought somebody would get fed up and defected. I know, I believe, at the end of the Korean War, one of the North Korean pilots defected in the MiG-15.
Right.
I think that was slightly after the war, though. It wasn't before. But, yes, I did see the letter that came into the detachment commander's office about how to handle defecting planes and pilots.
Huh. Okay. All right. Another thing that you mentioned in the questionnaire, you talked about an Air Force fireman losing his arm while trying to save
him. Yeah, I remember that distinctly. I mentioned earlier that the F-4 Phantoms kept I believe one or two jets were always kept on alert status. We used to give, make a special, prepared a special briefing package for them. They were there to go at a moment's notice. In other words, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as opposed to the regular missions where they were, you know, going to strike this target this day or this location. This was strictly, you know, troops in contact, under fire, being pinned down. We need you to help us. And they would scramble them. And they were scrambled, I guess it was just before the sun came up, because I was reporting in for work. And apparently what had happened was the, I guess the pilot, F-4 was had a front seater and a back seater. Pilot might have been somewhat sleepy, and he apparently became disoriented on takeoff, and he mistook the line for the end of the runway for the center of the runway, went off the runway, and, you know, the plane crashed, caught on fire. One of the firemen went in there and tried to drag him out, and the fireman survived. The two crew members died. The fireman lost his arm in the process. But this gives you an idea, you know, why, you know, I was upset when, you know, people protested against veterans, Vietnam, you know, servicemen. People did above and beyond their job.
Sure.
It wasn't a matter that they were instituting policy. It was a matter of, you know, of they were doing what they were supposed to do. It's the government that does the policy, you know, takes
right.
their thing. And the fact that this fireman, you know, lost his arm, it's right in line with this Jewish pararescueman that in an attempt to rescue a pilot was made a POW for 7 years.
Right.
And I don't think people fully appreciate, you know, the extent that people went to do their job and to help their fellow servicemen.
Sure, sure, right. Okay. Absolutely. One more question I wanted to mention. When we talked on the phone the other day, you talked about the Rutgers Memorial. Could you kind of talk about that again?
Not at all. What happened was the class of 1965 at Rutgers, which was the class that graduated the year before me,
right.
decided that as their class gift, they wanted to do something for the Rutgers servicemen that were killed in, or missing in action in Vietnam.
Okay.
And what they came together was actually a memorial, which in some ways is more striking than the memorial in Washington, D.C.
Right, okay.
There's 15 or 16 names there. I have... Hello? Yeah, okay. It just means somebody else is trying to call through, but don't worry about it. That's
okay.
All right. I have an answering thing. What it was is they have a... they set up each name on like a little column, and when the... as the sun rises in the sky, each column with a name underneath it lights up,
okay.
just as a person's life does. As the sun, you know, starts to set in the sky, slowly, one by one, each one of these columns goes into the shadows. This was, it was to be dedicated, I believe it was October 30th of 1993. I mean, this is like over 20 years after the war ended. A couple of days before it was going to be dedicated, it was defaced. And Air Force ROTC set up a 24-hour honor guard around it to make sure that no more defacement would occur to the monument before dedication. To me, you know, something like this after World War II would have never been done. It's sad. I mean, you know,
sure.
This is part of the reason why I pushed to get my degree from Texas A&M. I have no animosity against the Ag School. They were good to me. They helped me. They were nice people. But there's this general thing that goes on at Rutgers that, again, the atmosphere such that it led to that, you know, defacement of the monument. That's their way of being a hero.
Right.
These people can't speak for themselves anymore. They're dead.
Right.
That really upset me. I was going to go. My mother gave me some money to get a good dinner. I couldn't. I was just sickened after that. The thing that really hurt, because I know two of the people up there personally.
Okay.
One, Mark Shanice, went through 4 years of ROTC at Rutgers with the Air Force, was a pilot. He was flying F-100s out of Phan Rang, which was about 40 miles south of Cameron.
Okay.
I was in country 2 weeks after he was killed. His plane had to make an abort on takeoff and blew up. And I have heard stories of planes blowing up, and people were beginning to question whether the Vietnamese were sabotaging them, because some had access to base. On some bases, there was more Vietnamese access than others, and there were a number of aircraft accidents that couldn't be explained. And again, we went. I didn't know him real well, but we knew each other.
Right.
When you go through 4 years of a large state school and you have the same class together for 4 years, and of course, once you go advanced ROTC in the mid 60s, you make generally 50, 60 at the most at that time.
Okay.
So you knew each other, you know, by first name. I felt bad about that.
Sure.
The other one is Phil Mascari, is a real sad story. He's a real bright kid, very friendly, very nice. He dropped out of Rutgers for a year to pick up his grades. All he wanted to do was be a pilot. He graduated a year after me, but I knew him because, like I said, we went through the first couple of years of ROTC together. Real friendly, you know.
Right.
He probably could have been a governor of New Jersey eventually. He was shot down over Laos on a flying as a forward air controller. His father went on all kinds of missions to see if they could find him or if he was a prisoner of war, eventually, supposedly, to recover parts of his remains. His name was up there, too. I mean, these were not guys that's, you know, let's go kill the commies type of.
Right.
It was their way of fulfilling their military obligation was to serve as pilots in the Air Force. And they were killed in that process, so they should be honored.
Absolutely.
To deface their monument. I do have a picture that I'm going to send to you that I scanned of the dedication of the monument and an article from the Rutgers Targum about the defacement and about the monument. Again, it is really nice the way it's set up. It's across from a dormitory that I used to live in the main part of the campus. And again, the fact that it represents passage through life and the fact that all of these students once traversed this area where the monument is,
right.
It's strange. It's like I mentioned the scene from 12 o'clock high, you know, walking over the busy airfield that is now a cow pasture.
Right.
It's just odd. But at least they were remembered. So I'm grateful for that. New Jersey also has a large Vietnam Memorial and Education Center at the Garden State Arts Center on the Parkway.
Okay.
But, of course, the Rutgers Memorial is, I guess, more poignant to me because of the teach-ins that were held there, the fact that a number of these people went through ROTC, two of them, you know, that I knew.
Right.
There was also, well, my squadron commander, when I was a freshman at Rutgers, Joe Milligan was shot down and was a POW. Interestingly, he stayed in the Air Force. He went back to Rutgers under Air Force as active duty, wore his uniform, they say, all the time, got his master's degree. Eventually, I think the Air Force either sent him for his PhD somewhere else or his veterinary medicine, and he eventually retired as a colonel, but as either a PhD in animal science or as a veterinarian. They told me, this is after I left you know, after I finished the graduate program. He did wear his uniform to class all the time. He was greeted well with respect at Rutgers. But, of course, most of his classes were at the Ag School, which, again, never had a problem with ROTC or military, and a lot of the faculty were reserve officers anyhow.
Right.
So I was glad to hear that. That's one of the better stories.
Sure, absolutely. All right. Well, before we wrap things up, is there anything else we should mention, anything else we should cover?
No, I think that pretty well covers it.
Okay.
I think the only thing that I would say is it's been an interesting journey for somebody that loves weather and history and military history. I paid a price for it, but I don't regret it. I got a chance to do some very interesting things. I just regret at the way I was treated by both the government and a lot of civilians when I returned.
Sure.
I don't think anything can ever rectify that. Hopefully it'll never happen again.
Right.
And I do have the two books that you're interested in, and I'll mail to your address there.
Absolutely.
And the printed up part of the diary and some stuff on Cameron Bay that may be of interest.
Okay, well, thank you. We will certainly appreciate that. Well, and also I want to say thank you for your time, for taking the time to do this. But let me go ahead and stop the interview. But